Coming up on Boston Public Radio, you've all seen the video many times. The chokehold, the repeated I can't breathe, a death, and yet again, no indictment. We'll get your reaction and ask what can be done. And on Monday, Boston 2024 submitted its bid to host the Summer Olympics. A chief critic of the plan and someone who studied Olympic Games joins us at noon, Smith College's Andrew Zimbalist.
Our science editor, Heather Goldstone, takes us on a journey from outer space to Earth's inner space and explains why they're technological cousins. Then we'll talk to you again about the latest grand jury failure to indict a white police officer who killed an unarmed black man. And Edgar B. Herwig III will answer three questions inquiring minds. That's yours, WGBH listeners. Want to know? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie. So on July 16th, only a handful of people knew who Eric Garner was. Today the world knows. Maybe we don't know much about how he lived, but we all know how he died.
No, I don't accept his apology. No, I could care less about his condolences. No, I could care less. He's still working. He's still getting a paycheck. He's still feeding his kids. And my husband is 6 feet under.
How could we put our trust in the justice system when they fail us like this?
Not just a black problem or a brown problem or a Native American problem. This is an American problem. When anybody in this country is not being treated equally under the law, that's a problem.
It's a very hard thing to spend time trying to comfort someone you know is beyond the reach of comfort because of what he's been through. I can only imagine. Couldn't help but immediately think what it would mean to me to lose Dante. Life could never be the same thereafter, and I could feel how it will never be whole again. Things will never be whole again for Mr. Garner.
The grand jury, as you know, declined to indict the New York City police officer who used the chokehold on Garner, which ultimately killed him. You know, we try to be as even-handed here as one can possibly be, but it's hard to say that this decision, it could not have been worse. The timing could not have been better, though. This comes 1 week after the grand jury's decision on the fatal shooting of Michael Brown. It happened on the exact same day the 12-year-old Tamir Rice, he was the one shot dead by a rookie cop in Cleveland.
12.
Did I say, what did I say?
I know what you didn't say.
Oh, I'm sorry. 12-year-old was shot dead by a rookie cop in Cleveland. He was buried yesterday. Now it's really hard to deny for anybody. There's a real problem in America when it comes down to blacks and law enforcement. So we're going to take your calls on the grand jury's decision on the death of Eric Garner at 877-301-8970. And now that it's clear, I assume to even those who have been in denial, what do we do to begin to fix this? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I'm assuming the vast majority of you were like me. We had seen the video a half dozen times in the last few months. I saw it maybe 50 times last night, watching coverage from right till before I went to bed. As was Jeffrey Toobin, who I really admire, who's chief legal analyst. We had him on a year or so ago. Chief legal analyst at CNN said, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, I'm usually the moderate here. I'm usually the one that is the balanced opinion. And he went on to say, even if it turns out this was not a murder, there was no crime committed by the police officer, none, no lesser criminal behavior. It is staggering. And you say, I said to Marty before we went on the air, and this is surely not an original thought, what do you say to blacks in America today who say, what more proof do you need that this system exists, two different systems exist for two sets of people in this country? There are two Americas. It is just, it is scandalous.
Well, also, you know, this maneuver, this so-called chokehold maneuver was banned by the police department 20 years ago. So to be using that maneuver in the first place is something that this police officer shouldn't have been doing. And I think, you know, we've all been talking about cameras this week. Obviously, you know, the point's been made, and I'll make it again, that cameras is not necessarily going to solve the problem because this thing was seen by millions of Americans, this whole death of Mr. Garner, and everyone heard those last words that we heard him say, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And we saw it, we heard it, and that didn't seem to make a difference anyway. I mean, grand juries, as we've talked about before, you know, the prosecutors bring in their evidence, and they usually bring in their evidence because they want an indictment. They're prosecutors. Mm-hmm. They're trying to indict someone. And the joke is that they can indict anybody they want because they skew the evidence. And I think what we're seeing here is, it seems to me anyway, is the reverse, where in Missouri, in the Ferguson case, and in this case, it doesn't seem to me the prosecution wanted an indictment, because if they had, I think they could have gotten one.
And by the way, the other piece of this that I am embarrassed to say I hadn't thought about much till last night either is expressed by Ben on our Facebook page. They should have written him a ticket. This is for selling the loose cigarettes. Handed it to him and walked away. No reason to even lay hands on Eric Garner. I mean, keep in mind, that's the underlying crime here. The underlying crime for which Eric Garner was confronted is that he was allegedly selling what are called loosies, loose cigarettes. There's a tax violation. There are actually pretty significant fines in New York for this. But that led to this. It is absolutely amazing to me. As you've heard, the Attorney General Eric Holder is conducting a civil rights investigation to see if the civil rights of Eric Garner were violated. Most legal experts, and I surely don't include myself in this category, say that a civil rights violation being found in the case of Michael Brown is much tougher, that here there is a pretty decent likelihood that this is going to come. And I also say, you know, when you hear this guy, I don't know if it was 9, 10, 11 times, when you hear him saying, "I can't breathe,"
I know.
And then you hear Congressman from New York, Peter King, say, "Well, if he couldn't breathe, he couldn't speak," and then congratulating the grand jury for doing justice and resisting outside pressure. What world are we living in? I mean, it's surreal. 877-301-8970. By the way, the grand jury is 15 whites, 8 blacks. Unlike Ferguson, where we all learned about Missouri grand juries, there are 12 people in the grand jury out there. 9 had a vote for an indictment. Obviously, they didn't. That's 3/4. In New York counties, as Staten Island here, there are 23 members of the grand jury. Only 12, only a majority, had a vote. Forget murder again. For anything, any violation, any criminal violation against Garner, a majority voted for none of those.
I think what we've learned talking about these cases, and most of us probably knew it before, is that African Americans look at the police in a different way than white Americans do, and Hispanics to a certain degree too, because white people see the cops as they're going to rescue them in their travails. And I think African Americans, especially if you're a young black man, do not look at the police as somebody who's going to rescue you. They look at the police as somebody who's going to pull you over for sketchy reasons and possibly shoot you. So we've all heard the stories about black fathers and mothers telling their kids that the cops pull you over, you know, keep your hands on the steering wheel. If you're going to go get your wallet, you're going to get your registration, say, "I'm opening the glove compartment now to go get my registration." In our own lives, with friends of ours, in our own towns, we've seen this over and over and over again. So there's a big difference here. And I think one of the reasons that we're having such a terrible difficulty getting these indictments is because there's a different attitude toward the police among white Americans and among white prosecutors. Prosecutors and the cops, you know, they're all working in the same office, Jim.
You know, there's a great editorial in the Boston Globe today. It's entitled, "Obama Must Push for Reforms at Nation's Police Departments." And I'll just read a piece of it. A Washington Post ABC News poll found that while 85% of African Americans, 61% of Hispanics disapproved of the grand jury's non-indictment of Darren Wilson and the death of Michael Brown, only 35% of white Americans disapproved. And they go on to say, "A serious self-examination would challenge white Americans to consider whether police homicide would be justified if the victim were a blonde, blue-eyed 12-year-old with a BB gun," obviously talking about Tamir Rice. Situation, "a white teen stealing cigars, as Brown allegedly did, or a white man selling loose cigarettes, as Eric Garner did before he was choked to death." And I mean, it's pretty simple, but boy, ask yourself that question. I mean, it is just, it's, and you know, this perception, I have to say, and I understand you've got to report it carefully. The coverage last night, once again, the reporters almost, in my opinion, almost begging for there to be some horrible thing to happen, was totally peaceful. There was nonviolent protest. And we had to hear every second sentence. Well, no violence, no violence. I mean, almost anticipating that this thing was going to happen. A lot of really angry people demonstrating seriously, as they should, about a two-class justice system.
Two quick things. There is going to be a protest tonight in Boston, on Boston Common at 7 o'clock at night, and there's going to be thousands of people there. And let's hope it is a
a
rainbow coalition protest, that there are many white people there, non-African-American people there as well. That's number one. And number two, I don't want to paint with a broad brush. I mean, there's a lot of police officers out there doing a very difficult job very well, but when people are off the rails like this, they had to be held responsible. And one last thing, I told
you. What did Evan say? But stay on that. When we asked Evans about this, Commissioner Evans, when he was here a week or so ago, about whether situations like Darren Wilson's, which I would argue is not nearly as clear-cut as this one, happen, doesn't the taint of that trickle down onto all the good cops? He said, without missing a beat, the answer was yes.
Well, it does, and that's why it behooves, I think, prosecutors and police officers to when someone steps out of bounds, that they go after them, because exactly as you said, it makes people suspicious of everybody. Anyway, 877-301-8970 is our number, 877-301-8970. Let's start with Edward from Fall River. Hi, Edward.
Hello, Edward.
Hi, it's me again, guys. I love you both so much. I love your show. We need more people like you in our country.
You're a kind
doing
soul.
What you're doing.
Thanks, Edward.
Mean
go ahead.
Sincerely, guys.
Thanks.
Really.
We know you do. Thank you.
I cried my eyes out when I saw this happen this summer, and my heart went out then as it does now, because it's twice as bad now that this officers, I'm talking paramedics, everybody that was there should be guilty of this crime. This was murder. This was absolute murder. And I have something to add to this, but God bless his family and the soul of Eric. And I'm going to try my best to get out to Boston this evening. But there's also a case in Arizona, and I have one or two other quick comments, guys, and I'll listen. Michelle Cusso in Arizona, a 50-year-old. Why we haven't heard more about Michelle Cusso is only God knows, but a 50-year-old African-American suffering from mental illnesses that her mom and dad were able to take care of for 50 years. She didn't want to go to the wedding that she was invited to with her parents that have been so nice to take care of her all these years, okay? They went to L.A. from Phoenix and got a call from the authorities. And unfortunately, all of the resources that they were so used to having at their disposal, okay, were not available at this exact time and place. Michelle was having an episode at her apartment building in Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, Arizona, when the psych hospitals and all of the support that she had normally with her folks in town, unfortunately, she did not have.
So
and my
what,
heart goes out to Michelle Cusso. What happened next was an absolute crime.
Before you go ahead, by the way, is this a situation in Arizona where Eric Holder, the attorney general, did find a civil rights violation on the part of the local police? Is this the same case?
I you know what? I really don't know.
Okay,
really,
so what happened? What happened with the police and this woman, Edward?
Okay. Well, they sent out a SWAT team, literally a SWAT team, for a little petite girl by the name of Michelle Cusso. They banged on her door. She said, I'm okay. I don't need any help. Why are you here? She had a little tiny kid's hammer the size of a pen in her hand when they knocked down the door and scared the living tar out of her, and then they shot her in the head and killed her. This was just this summer. Why isn't anybody talking about the sweet soul of Michelle Cusso? All the neighbors love this poor woman.
Edward.
She needed help, and they showed up with guns and killed her. They murdered her, and they got away with it. They investigated their own murder trial. The Phoenix Police Department investigated their own case, and nothing was done.
Edward, we're going to look into this,
yeah,
and by the way,
and
see if this is the one that Holder did.
Thank you very much for bringing that case to our attention, because I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know about this either. But, Edward, thank you for the call, and we will look into it further. John from Gardner. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hi, folks. How are you today?
We're good.
Excuse me. A couple of things I've heard and observed this morning watching and listening to other things. Some are denying the racist component to this, and that saying that race isn't necessarily a factor. Some are blaming the Mayor de Blasio and his supposedly pushing on this new law. The law is new as of 2014.
You mean the cigarette-selling law?
About selling loose cigarettes on the street.
And
not talking about the officer's judgment or lack thereof.
Well, I don't know, but when you say the new law, a law on so-called loosies has been around forever. What, has he stepped up the penalties or something?
I heard it reported that that law came on the books in 2014.
I don't think that's true. But in any case, go ahead. I'm sorry, Joe. I believe you're wrong, but the report is
wrong.
But go ahead.
Stephen King, I heard that. You probably didn't hear Bo Dietl on Fox.
No.
To put it mildly, he was bombastic, as usual, but he said it was a good, just clear-cut, good decision by the grand jury.
Well, that's what Peter King, it's Peter King, the congressman, not the novelist, for those who are upset with their favorite novelist from Maine, Peter King. I mean, you've been in the law enforcement system for a long time. Isn't this a situation where it'd be really helpful if fellow police officers and police organizations spoke to how upset they were with this thing here, so they're not painted with the same brush that this that the Pantaleo is being painted with?
I do, and I think the component of common sense and judgment is so important in these fields. Just plain old common sense and judgment. You can see, if you look at that video, there's a shot of it, and we've all seen various snippets and not seen others, and I haven't seen the whole 15-minute thing, but there's a shot when they show the number 99 with his hands, I don't know, he's in a very aggressive stance, and what people are missing, they're just waiting for the backup to show up because they know he's a big, powerful man, and they're going to take him down.
But why? But John, the underlying thing is I read the first Facebook posting for a crime, and I use the term loosely, like selling loose cigarettes. Why do you apprehend anybody anyway? You don't have anything. Five cops, and I think there were five on the scene, five cops don't have anything better to do than arrest someone, even if they did it peacefully, for selling loose cigarettes?
It's unbelievable. And another thing, people are saying there's no commonality between this and Ferguson. Well, you know what? Two grand juries didn't indict, and the cases are different. But two grand juries didn't indict, and there's a community asking why, and it should have been put out in the open.
John, thank you much for the call, as always. By the way, the Michelle Cousseau thing that Edward was talking about, the family, this is according to our colleagues who checked it out, family called for a Department of Justice investigation, and we're checking on whether or not they got it. And as of late August, the Phoenix police were doing an alleged independent probe. But I have to say, there was some Arizona police force, if you guys could check this too, where Holder, the attorney general, actually has found a civil rights violation is proceeding. I'm just not sure if it's
point
this
out
case.
Locally, you've done stories on it, and so have I. The case of D.J. Henry, an 18-year-old young man who was at Pace University outside of New York City, was killed by a white police officer. He was black. He was killed in October of 2010. They began a federal civil rights investigation in that case, too. It's 4 years later. What are they doing?
I have no idea.
What are they doing? I mean, you've interviewed the mother and father that you
many
could not
times.
Ask
Angela
for.
And Dan, two of the finest people I've ever met.
Exactly, and total, complete class acts. I don't know how they can, you know, be so patient. No explanation for why this is taking so long. We're getting emails with other people's stories of other people that were killed that I've never heard of either. We should look those up as well.
Well, by the way, there was also a great story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday where it turns out, based on how this kind of behavior, police killing of a suspect, is grossly underreported national statistics based on by hundreds and hundreds over the last handful of years. But the latest examples, we all know the names now, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, little 12-year-old boy in Cleveland, and obviously Michael Brown. We're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She is Marjorie. And we're obviously talking about the grand jury decision yesterday in Staten Island not to indict the police officer who administered a chokehold, which killed Eric Garner, obviously coming just days after the grand jury failed to indict a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, for the death of Michael Brown, and coming on the exact same day as the funeral for the 12-year-old kid, Tamir Rice, from Cleveland, who was in that park and was shot by and killed by a police officer.
I want to thank Ryan, who just emailed us about the case of 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones, a black little girl from Detroit, killed by the police while she was asleep on the couch during a no-knock raid at her home. And there have been mistrials in her cases, two of them that we know of, and no charges against the police officer. at this point either. I also want to mention something that Andrew said, following up on what John from Gardner just said over the phone, that he thinks race is obviously a big problem here, but it's also beyond that. It is about the increasing heavy-handed tactics of police forces around the country in many instances, the unqualified defense of bad police tactics by their unions, and the militarization that's gone on after 9/11 with all this, you know, riot gear and these tank-like up-armored vehicles and all this heavy weaponry, that there seems to have been a movement to, you know, instead of going out and doing the community policing, just come out with the heavy weapons and the tanks when you're facing unarmed protesters. That's a new trend and an upsetting one.
Well, a trend that's upsetting the president, too, because one of the things he announced on Monday is to try to cut back on this militarization. You know, and no, I don't know if it's the same Ryan or another Ryan did a Facebook posting with which I'd like to disagree. He said, well, it shuts down the body cams will solve our problems argument pretty quickly. Obviously, we can't trust prosecutors or the courts to punish cops who use excessive force. I think we need citizens review boards, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with all that. The place I don't agree with is body cams are necessary. If we didn't have a video, even though it wasn't on a police officer, it was a friend of Eric Garner, you know what we'd be saying? There was no chokehold. There was no chokehold. The guy had asthma. He was obese. He fell down at one point. We at least have the visual truth here, even though there's no justice coming out of the grand jury. It is critical that we get these videos. It is sadly, it's without the video. You mentioned this point yesterday in another context, Marty. Without the video, there wouldn't be the uproar that we're seeing and hearing throughout the country.
It's seeing it. It's the old cliche, picture worth a thousand words. And by the way, there's that town, I think it's Rialto in California, where they do say that the use of the cameras there has dropped complaints by 88%. So that's a pretty significant number. It's not going to solve everything, but it's going to solve, or at least help solve, some things. Steve from Taunton, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Steve.
Hi. My buddy was a public defender out of Suffolk Court during the Rodney King beating. And I remember saying to him, "This boy, that was awful, that beating." And my friend started laughing. I said, "What's so funny?" He says, "Stevie, that stuff happens in the inner city every day." And all of a sudden, people are concerned. And they were concerned because it was caught on video.
Yeah,
of course.
Great point, Steve.
Well, and one other point. You know, it's a misconception that only African-Americans warn their children about driving while black and putting their hands on the steering wheel. My sons are 30 and 25, and they were at that stage in their life where I have my rights.
Yeah.
And I told them, you know what? If a cop says to you, jump, you say, how high? If a cop tells you to do anything, you do it because you're in a no-win, all right? Now, I'm not saying that incident was a tragedy this past year, but I'd like to think that if that man just turned around and offered his hands, he'd still be alive. I'm not saying it was right, but I think if people just listen to cops and just right or wrong, do what they say, I think we'd all be much better.
But you know, Steve, you're right that you tell your sons, particularly sons, white, black, whatever they are, you know, don't argue with the cops. But isn't that a terrible state of affairs that you have to be thinking the cops are going to shoot you if they pull you over because you got a flat tire?
Well, also to be in a position where your kids don't argue with the cops, they have to be stopped to begin with. And the only place where I'd quarrel with you, Steve, is it is much, much less likely that your white sons are going to be stopped to be put in that position than somebody's black sons. Like, for example, Eric Holder talked about it. Was it when he was a U.S. attorney from the Jersey or wherever it was?
Yeah.
He's driving down the Jersey Thruway or something. I don't remember where in Jersey. He stopped. Every African-American man I've ever spoken to, and I don't think that's an overstatement, with whom we've had this discussion, has Emmett Price talks about
everybody.
It. Everybody has had one of these moments. And I have to say, most white men I know have not. But you make a good point other than that,
well,
Steve.
I told
thank
you about
Nicole.
The elderly probation officer stopped outside of my house in Brookline and flashed his badge, 60 years old, pulled over. He wasn't even driving. He was just parked. They asked him for an ID. What are you doing here?
You're talking about the probation officer who was a black guy you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
877-301-8970. I have to say, I've rarely seen there be such unanimity on Facebook. Diane says, I'm just reading short pieces of what they've written. I think it points to a huge class rift in this country, also essentially corrupt social structure. Crystal says, considering the death, we should have mentioned this, was ruled a homicide by the medical examiner.
Yeah, I don't understand
the decision
this
by the
either.
Grand jury to not indict is indefensible to me, and that is factually accurate, that it was ruled a homicide by the medical examiner saying it was the result of a chokehold and such things.
Kathy just emailed the same thing. She doesn't understand it. I don't understand it either, Kathy. Let's go to Greg.
And by the way, you know, we've discussed nonstop. What? We're going to talk to Andrew Zimbalist in about a half hour, who's been a major critic of the effort to get an Olympics here. One of the criticisms, even by supporters like the mayor, has been about transparency. You talk about this nonstop on and off the air. These grand juries. You know, fine, you can release transcripts, and apparently the Staten Island, but the proceeding itself is secret. And how do you deal with that? You deal with it the way Deval Patrick said on Meet the Press, is you have a trial. The trial is in public. If it's in federal court, you can't watch it, but at least reporters can watch it. If it's in state court, it will probably be on television or at least part of it broadcast, and you can see the evidence. You can see how it's presented.
But here's the other
thing. You can't
in
a grand jury.
That's right, because it's only one side. That's the problem. There's no other side. There's no defense lawyers in there.
No defense lawyers. That's right, even though theoretically both of these DAs, theoretically, as they said, presented all the evidence.
But how do we know that?
Exactly.
That's the other
thing. I agree.
I mean, you have to wonder whether, and you can certainly understand where there's mistrust about this, that the prosecutor decides who the witnesses are. The prosecutor decides who he's going to put up on the stand in front of the grand jury. So if he wants to get a different result, this is why there a lot of people object to this whole system of doing this grand jury the way we do it through time in memoriam, is that they can skew the result. I mean, and so we don't know in Ferguson or in this case who got to talk and who didn't get to talk.
Well, also, there's another thing. Is even for those who are listening to what Marjorie said and said, well, wait a second, the guy in Missouri is releasing all of the evidence. You don't know how the evidence was presented. You don't know what the look on the face or the expression of the prosecutor was when he was presenting evidence that was contrary to his basic theme.
You don't know if there were 15 people who disagreed with the police version and only 8 of them got to take the stand, and the 8 who got to take the stand were maybe not the best witnesses in the world and looked a little disheveled or looked a little out of it.
Very good point.
I mean, you know, those of you who've been to trials, and I've covered trials a million times, the demeanor of the witness is so important. There's a good, believable witness, and there's someone you think, I don't believe a word this person is saying. So it's subtle, or sometimes it's not so subtle. But the point is, I think prosecutors have enormous power in grand juries, and when they're secret, it makes me enormously skeptical. Greg from Lincoln, what do you think, Greg?
Hello, Greg.
Hey, guys.
Hi. Oops.
Oops.
On the whole grand jury issue.
We lost you. Lost everything other than hello. So yeah. Start over one more time. Sorry, we lost your connection.
Let's try again. Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfectly. Thank you.
Great. I mean, two quick comments. One of them is on the grand jury process.
Sure.
I think when you have situations like this where you have video, where this kind of it becomes a social issue as opposed to a local issue, I think you have to, you know, question the grand jury process and say, at what point do we kind of just forget about whether the officer is convictable or not, and say for the better kind of social good, this needs to go to trial.
Amen.
Regardless of the outcome.
I couldn't
right?
agree with you more.
Well, that's what Deval Patrick said, talking about the Ferguson case, that for trust purposes, it should have gone to a trial.
What's your other point, Craig?
Sorry, Marjorie. Yeah, and to your point, I mean, when it goes to a trial, the actual information gets out there, which I think, you know, information is power. And we've solved so many problems by getting more data out there. And that's my second point, which is, you know, the media is selective, right? So we don't know about all the people of color who've been killed in all different situations because some things get publicized more than others. Let's put together some data about how many cops have been killed by people of color and how many people of color have been killed by cops. And let's actually get all those facts, because they're facts, right? Death is a fact. And let's put it together, and then maybe we can demilitarize the police forces where it's clear that cops are not being killed on a daily basis, but people of color are.
Greg, thank you much for your thoughtful call. We appreciate it.
Keith is emailing, and he's not necessarily on the side of the police in this case, but he's saying that you have to remember many police officers are gunned down when they pull people over, and maybe that's why they're on edge. That doesn't really work in this case, but I mean,
I'm so glad you said that. Watch the video.
Yeah.
Again, we've had a lot of discussion about Michael Brown. I'm sure you have in your households and your workplaces and with your
that
friends.
That was a much murkier.
Right, exactly. We don't have a video. It's not as clean a case. Look at the video and then see if you can write what you just wrote. It could not, at least in my estimation, be clear. Or not to mention the fact that these are
Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old right. child that was killed.
And remember, by the way, we mentioned this the other day. I don't know if you know, this 12-year-old kid who was killed by a cop in a young black boy killed by a white cop in Cleveland. The original story told by the police officer was that there were three boys sitting together, that when the cop stopped the car, they asked him, I believe it was three times, to drop the gun. And then a video appeared, and a video showed, one, there was only one boy sitting here, Tamir Rice, who is now dead, and two, that there was only a space of 2 seconds from the time the police car drew to a stop. Is that proper English, drew to a stop? Yeah. Came to a stop, and the point at which the cop fired the gun that killed the little boy. How in 2 seconds do you say three times, please drop the gun?
You know, wonder, and I'm not trying to make a joke here, but if third time's a charm, if we're going to get an indictment in this case, because it's a 12-year-old kid and the country can't take a third non-indictment? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't even know what the status of that is. I assume there's a grand jury convened there as well. But again, the irony, the horrible irony of Tamir Rice was buried yesterday, the same day that the grand jury out of Staten Island came down with no charge against the police officer, or any of the police officers, by the way. There were five of them, but one administering the chokehold that, as Marjorie said, was banned, not illegal, but banned 21 years ago by the New York City police for the great crime of selling loose cigarettes, allegedly, on a street in Staten Island.
Stephen from Connecticut. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, thanks, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi. You know, Attorney Loretta Lynch, you know, in the 2nd District, is going to be taking this case. And she is going to be replacing Attorney General Holder. She's got to go in there and do a full body slam on this Gardner thing. This will change American policing forever. It's all under these cases like Graham v. Connor, you know, use of force cases, which governs how they get into these things. Now, this is outside of this grand jury, which is just a total farce. It's a farce. We all recognize it as a farce. When you see a video, that just, it's shameful. Shameful, and I'm embarrassed.
By the way, the first point you made, we should clarify that Lynch, who has been nominated to succeed Eric Holder, her jurisdiction as U.S. attorney, which is now what she is, includes Staten Island, where this was done. So if it turned out that she had not she hasn't been elevated yet, but assuming she's confirmed by the Senate, becomes Attorney General, she'd be the one who'd be doing the investigation that the Department of Justice has announced is happening. But go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, she's got to go in there and fight the good fight. And if she doesn't, as one of the fellows told me, whispered in my ear, it's over, Johnny, for her.
Well, Stephen, let me tell you.
In the eyes of the civil rights community.
She's, from what I've read about her, she's very good on civil rights and, like her predecessor, very bad on banks. And so is Eric Holder on both those counts. So hopefully, at least on the former, she continues her track record. Stephen, thank you.
And we should remember Nancy Gertner, the retired federal judge who wrote the piece, and you interviewed her on your television show.
Yeah.
She wrote a piece in the Globe saying that part of the problem here, too, is Supreme Court decisions, which have come down on the side of what seems to be excessive force by the people who brought charges, and the Supreme Court has ruled in favor of cops in these cases, making it easier to not pay the price for using excessive force.
Well, yeah, but I spoke to Nancy after the Michael Brown thing, or Judge Gertner after the Michael Brown thing. I have not spoken to her in the last 24 hours. I am telling you, while I haven't read all these Supreme Court cases, there is no Supreme Court case that precluded that grand jury in Staten Island from indicting this guy. If you just tuned in, they didn't have to indict him for murder or nothing like they did. There were a lot of lesser offenses, crimes.
Involuntary manslaughter.
For which they could have been convicted. Or assault
and battery,
or something.
The dangerous weapon.
Exactly. Is there anything? There's no crime that would, I mean, what do you tell your kid? Forget what do you say to black Americans. What do you tell your son or daughter who watches that video, who turns to you? We both have kids, Marjorie. Your kid turns to you. Assume our kids were younger and didn't understand as well as hopefully they do. Your kids are younger and say, why isn't that officer being charged with – I watched that video, Mom, about a dozen times. Why isn't he being charged with something? What's the answer to the question?
you don't have an answer to the question. And then you give your kids the big speech that parents across America, and if you're black, you give it every single solitary chance you get. Don't argue with the cops. Don't argue with the cops. Don't argue with the cops. And I really resent having to always say don't argue with the
cops. Well, by the way, also, if you listen to what was happening here, Garner was complaining that he'd been harassed historically by one of these police officers. He was not physically in any way. He was having a verbal disagreement with these cops. Please stay away from me. Don't do this. He used the word please, actually, in the middle of this thing, even though it may have been sarcastic. And then all of a sudden, this Pantaleo was coming up behind him, putting him in a chokehold, getting him down on the ground. And again, if you the most heartbreaking part of this is if you listen to him saying, I can't breathe, and then hear a United States congressman from New York having the audacity to say, Peter King, if he couldn't breathe, he couldn't have spoken those words, is just unconscionable. It is unconscionable. If Peter King's fear is if you say that the police officer here should have been indicted for something, that you're indicting all cops, then you're a fool. You're, of course, not indicting cops who do their jobs well and responsibly and without any sort of racial motivation. You're basically saying this cop did wrong. He committed a crime. He killed this guy, which is exactly what he did. Let's take one more.
Sue from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Sue.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
First and foremost, I love your show.
Thank you.
You know, above and beyond the racial issues here, which I think are disgusting, cops shouldn't be held above the law. I mean, they should be accountable for their actions. And I get there's some responsible cops out there, but what scares me about this is if they're going to get away with it, you know, with the black people, you know, what's next? Are we all going to be fearful of them? It's ridiculous. The militarization, sorry, that's a tough word, and just the fact that they do this and can get away with it, what's going to happen next? It scares the heck out of me.
Well, I think you probably have less to fear. I mean, you say, you know, they came for them. Are they going to come for me next? I mean, the history would suggest they're probably not going to come for you. They're going to continue to come for people whose skin color is not white. I mean, it's a painful thing for a lot of people to deal with, but that's the reality.
I think there's also the young man thing, the man thing. This happens less often to women. It happens to women, obviously. We just heard about that horrible case in Arizona, but there's a mano on the street thing going on. Oh, yeah? You're going to give me some lip? Oh, yeah? Well, I got the big gun. I mean, it just escalates very, very quickly in some cases, not in all cases.
Yeah, especially when you're selling loose cigarettes on the street in Staten Island. Watch the video, watch it again, and then watch it again. Again, Sue, thanks for the call. We're going to spend a lot more time on this later in the show.
Yes, we are. We're going to get back to it just a little bit later. But up next, we're going to take a break, talk to Kara Miller about the future of urban planning and making an aerotropolis the airport-centered city is next. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In 1939, I remember it well, Popular Science published a futuristic illustration of a skyscraper with an airport on the roof. The concept was called Aerotropolis. Well, the fantasy of an airport in the city apparently is becoming a reality. Here with us in Studio 3 to elaborate is GBH's Kara Miller. She is, of course, you know, host of Innovation Hub. Hi there, Kara.
Hi.
Okay. I don't really – I kind of like that Logan is right, you know, not on the roof of my house.
Right.
But tell us about what this means, this Aerotropolis deal.
So let me just start with this. I have always thought of the area around airports as a place where generally poorer people live. And in a lot of places, that is exactly true, right?
Yep.
Rich people do not want to live near the pollution. They don't want to live near the sound of the planes flying all the time.
China shaking when the planes go
over. Right, exactly. But, you know, that's really starting to change. So I give you as sort of exhibit a place called South Lake, Texas, which some people may know, right outside the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. I mean, like, you can see the mega mansions when you come in and you're flying in. But some people call it the most affluent neighborhood in the country. The average house is over $750,000.
Really?
To buy. Yep.
How close to the
average
and that's one
income.
Of the biggest airports in the country.
Yes, exactly.
How close?
I think it's just like 10 minutes. Uh-huh. I mean, it's right there. It's right outside the airport. So, and the reason is because as we see things get more connected digitally with the internet, right, we also see, and this comes from John Casarda, who is like the godfather of the Aerotropolis at UNC. This is the internet of people. So all of us know people who are consultants, right, who leave on Monday and come back on Thursday or Friday, and they go to a different place every week, right, and they work with a company. And what do they use to get around? Not cars anymore, not boats. I mean, Boston is a big city because of boats. New York is a big city because once upon a time, we all went on boats.
Those were the days, Kara.
Those were the days, Marjorie. The future is people making business deals in Chicago and heading home to Miami that night. That is the future. The future is getting packages by Amazon. How do you think Amazon gets packages from one place to another? On planes.
Yeah.
So you have like the digital internet, which has changed everything. And then you have the physical internet, which shuttles people all over the place.
You know why this is not surprising to me at all? Is this is exactly what we've – you know, people are big advocates of high-speed rail, like Mike Dukakis. And
right.
Marjorie and I are both huge train fans,
I would love if we could get to New York
me.
In
oh
an hour
God.
And a half.
Or if
oh
you go to
God.
Chicago or California. I mean, you can, but it's going to take you forever.
Oh,
high-speed,
yeah.
Can you imagine?
I once
would
took a
everything.
Train to Iowa.
You did?
Worst mistake I ever made.
What, going to Iowa or taking a train
no,
to Iowa?
No, Iowa's
kidding.
Fantastic.
How long
but
did
the point,
it take
wait,
you to get
me...
to Iowa, please?
To 24 hours on a train.
Oh, wow.
But
I
the
know.
Point I was trying to make is advocates for train travel, even things like South Coast Rail, make the case that wherever there's a stop on a train that currently is a barren or poor neighborhood, retail businesses are going to crop
right.
up. People are going to want to live because they want to be close to the transportation infrastructure to use. So it makes total sense to me that this is the case. And by the way, the reason it's needed, in my opinion, is you mentioned Logan.
Right.
The only airport I think I've ever been to in my whole life that is convenient in America, or the world for that matter, is Logan, which
well, now,
is actually
right.
in the city.
Because of the big dig.
All these other airports are like an hour
so
away
that,
from
so,
the city.
Okay, so that is starting to change. Two things are happening. One is the Dallas-Fort Worth story, which is, okay, maybe you build an airport outside the city, people come to the airport. I mean, whole cities now have popped up around airports because think about it. You've got places like Amazon that have big warehouses near airports. People work at those warehouses. There are hotels and conventions that go on near airports. I mean, you fly into L.A. If you've ever flown into LAX, there's like a city around LAX, right, because people work at those hotels. Then restaurants pop up. Then entertainment venues. So what we've seen is little cities popping up. But we also see in places in Asia, in the Middle East that are building cities, they are now building cities around airports, which is a problem for a place like JFK, which is no fun to fly into.
You know, I have one question about this so that I don't understand. You know, having done a million stories over the years about the people in Winthrop and you go to their house and the planes are flying over from Logan and everything's vibrating and the noise is deafening. I mean, you know, I don't want – who wants to live like that?
Right. So one thing is I think technology is getting better. I mean, and you see it now. I mean, people who live on Rose Wharf,
yeah.
right, are, you know, in Boston, very, very expensive places to
yes.
live. They're right near Logan. They can take a little shuttle, a little ferry and just over the water to Logan. So one thing is technology is getting better. So people are able to build much more substantial insulated homes that
with
don't
noise.
Feel that as much.
Noise things.
But also some of it's a trade-off. Some of it is saying, you know, we used to want to build the airports way far away. But look, if you're a business person and you're away all the time and you want to get home and see your kids and have dinner with them, then maybe flying into Logan and living out in Littleton is not really what you want.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there was a time, I mean, you know, Jim kind of touched on this, but I think there was a time definitely when rich people did not want to live in downtowns. They didn't want to live necessarily, you know, right near Logan. They wanted to live, you know, far away. They wanted to have space. And I think if you have to take a plane all the time and you want to spend the maximum amount of time with your family, you may rethink that.
Can I tell you, when I first moved here a couple of decades ago, mm-hmm. I used to commute almost every day. I mean, go down first thing in the morning, yep. come back last thing at night. Mm. The most aggravating part of it was not the plane flight. The most aggravating part was saying, right, oh, my God, when I finally land, it's going to take an hour even to get to Cambridge, even as close as Logan is because of traffic. I think the idea makes total sense. But it also makes – I mean, I am so pro-rail. It is ridiculous. And if people like the concept of this Aerotropolis thing you're talking about – It's in spades for the expansion of train travel. It's going to cause communities to spring up.
When we were talking about the history of things, that is why, in large part, Chicago is what it is because of train travel. The reason that Los Angeles is what it is because it rose up big time in the era of interstate highways, right? It is clearly a highway city, and it benefited tremendously from that. And then we talked about New York. The reason it is what it is because it rose up in the age of shipping, in the age of great ships.
You know what? Even though this isn't our topic, you talk all the time, Marjorie, about the infrastructure in this country, about how it's collapsing. There was a great 60 Minutes piece 2 weeks ago that was frightening. But you know,
they had hammocks underneath these bridges to catch the falling concrete.
Literally cement hammocks under the bridge in Pittsburgh. But beyond that, is there a Western nation that is underinvesting in high speed rail? Like this country is.
There probably isn't. And I will say, back to that 60 Minutes and the idea of investing in infrastructure, if you look at some European countries, at the Middle East, at Asia, their infrastructure in many of these places is incredible. So some of them have cities that they're actually building around airports. I went on a train in Shanghai that goes from the airport.
How come you're not mocking her when she says she was in Shanghai? I keep telling you I was in London last week. You mock me every time I say it. Why?
It's a matter of degree, Jim. The occasional mention is no problem.
Sorry,
please,
Kara,
proceed.
Go ahead.
So the airport in Shanghai is way the heck outside the city. Not close at all. I think it's like a 40-minute drive. But they decided that that was unacceptable for people who are flying in. And the traffic in Shanghai is a nightmare. I mean, if you think the traffic is bad here, it is a nightmare. So what did they do? They put in a high-speed train. Goes, I think, about 300 miles an hour. It's a maglev train, so it's magnetic. So the train is just above the track. So, I mean, like, it is like, you know, riding a train track, but on air. I mean, you can have a cup of tea, nothing spills. It's nothing like riding Amtrak. I mean, it's like sailing along the air. 8 minutes. 8 minutes from this thing that's 45 minutes outside the city of Shanghai, right to the center. The train track does one thing, takes you from the airport to the center, and then it goes right back. 8 minutes, cup of tea. It's awesome.
Okay, so since you mentioned Shanghai, I'll do my London example. If I just can't. No, you know what the argument
we
hear?
You saw the opening, right?
Every time either Rich Davey, who is now the former Secretary of Transportation, I think he's actually joining us next week for his farewell visit, Bev Scott, head of the T, we like them both. We respect them both a lot. You know the argument, why is the subway so crummy? It's that, well, it's old, it's this, it's an old city. Well, is London older than Boston or not? I believe it is.
Right.
Look at the tube. Look at the subway in that place, practically silent. You know what the seats are like? I haven't said this on the air yet. They are cushioned. They are literally like easy chairs on buses, which are two-deckers, and subways in a city much older. They've invested in the infrastructure. We in this country, again, it gets back to the only issue for politicians is what are you going to be able to tell your constituents today? What's the return?
There's
no long-term view about anything.
It's total mistrust of the political system, which is just getting worse and worse and worse. I mean,
they really trust their politicians in the UK,
don't they? I don't think it's a much different structure there in the UK than it is here. I mean, we talked about this on the front page of the Globe today about what you thought was a big scam in terms of judges.
The judges' pensions.
Yeah, so you see that, and you have taxpayers seeing that, and they say, the heck with you. That's what happened on the vote. Refused to index the gas tax because people don't trust the legislature. That's part of it.
It feels like with high-speed rail, you could make an argument. I mean, if New York was an hour and 20 minutes or something away, I mean, you could have there two people, right? Two a married couple could be living together, and one could work in Boston, one could work in New York.
Imagine
I mean,
that.
A lot of people spend an
business?
Hour and 20 minutes,
yeah,
right?
Commuting.
Well, oh, that too. But I mean, it would so open up where you could look for jobs
or,
without having to relocate or
and not only that,
settle.
But think about these places. We always talk about the struggling situation in Springfield or Worcester
yeah.
or New Bedford
yeah,
or Fall
yeah,
River.
Yeah, yeah.
If there were high speed rails,
yeah, they're
to
30
those,
minutes away.
It would
yeah.
change
yeah.
everything.
Do you know what the if we had a high speed rail, speaking of what you just mentioned, you get to the casino faster and lose your money
yeah.
at the casino.
It's distrust, Jim. That's what it's about.
Okay, enough of this for a second. You're discussing a word that I am obsessed with on Saturday in many contexts, denialism.
Yes.
What's the context in which you're talking about this?
So we're talking about this idea of, you know, we are in this age of science and we always talk together about sort of science and technology. But there is this large scale pushing back against science, not just from a few people, but from a lot of people. You see it in different ways. I mean, we've seen it in the Ebola outbreak with this kind of, you know, making people into pariahs who are in a family where somebody got Ebola. But we see it with autism,
yeah.
right? We saw that 1998 study by the doctor eventually
thing?
Got yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. Who linked the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, mm-hmm. to, you know, eventual autism in kids. He was taken out of the medical profession. The thing was thoroughly discredited. But it didn't matter. Like, the horse was out of the barn, and that had gained currency. And it sort of doesn't matter. Frontline did a huge thing looking at all the studies and showing that there was essentially no proof linking autism with measles, mumps, and rubella, this MMR vaccine, but it doesn't matter. There are measles outbreaks now. You see kids dying from whooping cough.
Which is awful.
Right. You saw a kid die from meningitis. So all these diseases that people haven't seen in 20, 30, 40 years are back because there's this sort of, you know, maybe pushing back against science, like maybe science doesn't really know, even if scientists say, no, we do know. And we see it with climate change, too. The incoming head of the Environmental Committee in the Senate will be Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, who does not believe yeah. in climate change. And he is not alone in rejecting the idea of climate change. So I don't know exactly what it is, and I actually think the media plays a little bit of a role.
Well, except you know where the media is starring yeah. since you met climate change, which we've only mentioned this on the show about 10,000 times. There's a pretty important newspaper in America,
yeah.
the LA Times.
Mm-hmm.
It will not print a letter from a writer who denies that climate change has a man-made component. They will literally not print it, no matter. Their view is there's no equivalency. There's
right.
no. You don't need both sides because
right.
there isn't a second
right.
side. So some may see it as
yeah.
censorship.
You know
they say the science just isn't there.
You know what all this denying is about, Jim?
What's that?
Distrust.
No, I think
it's the same concept.
I think it is. I think it is. And I think it's also this sort of idea that scientists have real trouble connecting with the public in some ways. And the media is the intermediary, and I don't know that they do a great job.
So what are you doing tonight? That's Saturday.
So tonight we're going to talk about Aerotropolis, which we talked about in the future of retail. And this weekend we'll talk about denialism and also what screens are doing to our kids and how they're affecting their learning.
Great.
I know the answer to that.
Too late for mine. It's all over. Karen Miller is the host of Innovation Hub, Thursday night at 9, Saturday at 10. We're going to get back to Eric Garner later on the show, the indictment or lack of indictment, but we're going to take a break to talk about the Olympics. Do host cities come out as winners or losers? That's what Boston's fate could be, coming up next on 89.7 WGBH.
On Monday, Boston 2024 submitted its bid to host the Summer Olympics. A chief critic of the plan and someone who studied Olympic Games joins us at noon. That's Smith College's Andrew Zimbalist. Then we're joined by The Globe's Alex Beam to discuss a dispute about the teaching of slavery in Brookline, a soccer championship in Foxborough, and whether we should care if Jesus and Mary really ever got hitched.
Our science editor, Heather Goldstone, takes us on a journey from outer space to Earth's inner space and tells us why they're technological cousins. Then we'll talk to you again about the latest grand jury failure to indict a white police officer who killed an unarmed black man. Then Edgar B. Hurwicke III will answer three questions inquiring minds, your minds, WGBH listeners, want to know. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio on 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So the bid is in. If you haven't been paying attention, on Monday, December 1st, Boston 2024 Organizing Committee submitted the formal bid to host the Olympics, obviously in 2024, the Summer Olympics here in Boston. We've heard their arguments. Hosting the Olympics would be good for economic development. It would speed up improvements in our infrastructure, position us as a state which could compete even better on a global scale. But would such a huge and prolonged investment in such a short-lived event really bring us the kinds of rewards that are being promoted? Joining us on the line is someone who has some serious doubts. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist and the Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith College. His latest book, which you can buy at Amazon right now, is Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and World Cup. Andrew Zimbalist, pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, I am very happy to be talking to you, Andrew Zimbalist, because you have serious doubts. After reading your stuff, I have mega serious doubts about the basic premise here from the organizers, which is that we can put on the Olympics in Boston without a taxpayer hosing. You don't think that's possible, so please tell us why.
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, I think you have to start with some skepticism about the numbers and the claims that they're making, because they have still not subjected them to public debate. And the reason they say they're not engaging public debate at this point is because their plans aren't sufficiently far along. So something is wrong with the inconsistent in the logic that they're using. The notion that this is going to cost $4 or $5 billion, I would urge people to remember that the Big Dig was supposed to cost $2 billion.
Exactly.
There are always massive cost overruns when you host a mega event, because what happens invariably is that the promoters come at first with bare-bones ideas and bare-bones architecture, and then once it's approved, then they discover, oh, well, we need a few extra infrastructural projects, and we need some luxury boxes, and we forgot about the restaurant in the Olympic Stadium, and so on and so forth. And the projects typically will go up in price by 3, 4, 5-fold. It's not at all uncommon. The Athens Olympics were initially budgeted at $1.6 billion, and they ended up at $16 billion. So I think that we haven't seen enough detail in the plans to be at all comfortable with a number of $4 to $5 billion, or to be comfortable really with a lot of the references they're making to specific facilities for the games. You know, you have to have about 33 or 34 venues for the games. The main venue is, of course, the Olympic Stadium. The Olympic Stadium has to be a stadium that holds 80,000. It has to be a stadium that has all the modern revenue-generating accoutrements, including luxury boxes and catering and restaurants and signage. The idea that you can build it and then tear it down is not very compelling. It's not something that's been done before with an Olympic stadium. Or the idea that you can use an existing stadium within the greater Boston area doesn't make any sense, because the existing football and soccer stadiums don't have tracks around them. And the existing track stadiums that there are at the various colleges in greater Boston don't have the seating capacity and don't have all of the other revenue-generating accoutrements. So you need a special stadium for the opening ceremonies and the closing ceremonies and the track and field events. And then you need natatoriums, and you need velodromes and beach volleyball courts and a golf course, and it goes on and on. Some of that stuff Boston, with modifications, Boston has, but a lot of the stuff it doesn't have. And the Olympics also comes with requirements for transportation ease among the various Olympic events, and special lanes for the Olympic executives who travel. And then you also need all sorts of communications infrastructure. And you're probably going to spend somewhere these days, and by 2024 it's going to be a lot more, but these days you spend about $2 billion on security. Some of that will come as help from the U.S. government, but U.S. government has not appropriated any funds for that yet. So I just, there's so many uncertainties, and then you have to ask the question: okay, suppose we spend $10 billion or $15 billion. By the way, London spent $20 billion, so I wouldn't. Yeah, go ahead.
And let me interrupt you here, because I interviewed last night, and both of us have interviewed John Fish quite a few times, who's the leader of this whole effort from Suffolk Construction. I interviewed last night the president of the whole effort, Boston 2024, Dan O'Connell. I want to play a sound from him in a minute and get your reaction to it, Andrew Zimbalist.
All right, sure, go ahead.
Because let me tell you my attitude about this. I don't care if a thing costs $100 million, as long as the rest of it is paid, billion dollars, pardon me, if all of the overrun is paid for not by the taxpayer. And I asked that question last night of O'Connell. He talked about how the city and state would be indemnified from any cost overrun on the Olympics. Here's what he said.
The surety bond situation and a construction situation, you're guaranteeing a price, and that if that price
so
is not
a dollar over or $10 billion over.
Yeah.
How about the state? I mean, this is also something where the state could be on the line. Would they be indemnified? Would they be covered by this bond?
It could be written to cover both. I'm not sure they'll be on the line for any of the cost of operating the games. The host city agreement is with the city that's the host, not with the Commonwealth.
So any government entity that could be on the hook for this thing will get this kind of thing as part of your plan.
So is that credible? He says to me outright, not an addition. If there, whatever the overrun is, if there is one, will be covered by the surety bond. Does that pass the laugh test?
No.
Why not?
Because there's a lot of ambiguity in that cut that you just played for me. First of all, the reference, as far as I can tell in that cut, is to the operating costs of the games. Mm-hmm. The operating costs of the games are relatively trivial. They're going to be around $4 billion, maybe $5 billion. It doesn't refer to the capital costs of the games. The capital costs of the games are building the facilities and building the roads and building the telecommunications infrastructure. If he's saying that when the plans are finally drawn up, that they'll make a deal with the construction companies that are going to be doing the building of the facilities, and that those deals will have written into them a guaranteed price, then it's possible, if the deals are written properly, it's possible that that guaranteed price will hold up. But that's not saying that he didn't say that it's all going to be private money to finance that. Are you really – this is a problem that Putin ran into with the Sochi Winter Games. Are you really going to have $800 million or $1 billion of private money building an Olympic stadium which won't be usable after the Games?
Well, they say, you know, that they say they're doing a temporary thing that ultimately could be shrunk in size and moved. So, and also in terms of these other facilities at universities, you've heard this too, Andrew. I don't know if it's credible or not. They say that universities will be partners in this. If they have to expand facilities, if they have to reconfigure facilities, that'd be at their cost.
Tufts says that they're interested in an auditorium. That's fine. So they'll build an auditorium. Maybe there'll be a nice auditorium with Olympic pools like they have at Harvard. But the natatorium that Tufts wants in the long run is not a natatorium for the Olympics. A natatorium for the Olympics is one that has several thousand seats, and it has catering facilities, and it has signage. And Tufts would be very, very ill-advised, and I can't believe that they would want to build an Olympic-style natatorium. They would like to have a natatorium that has the right swimming facilities, but all of the other accoutrements is not something that Tufts University needs. Do they have 5,000, 10,000 people who come to the Tufts swimming meets?
Andrew Zimbalist, to me, there is a fundamental problem here, and you've highlighted it in various stories that you've written, is that this is a potential boondoggle for construction companies. Construction unions, architectural
yes.
firms, investment bankers, and lawyers. And Deval Patrick, our governor, appointed a committee of 10 construction industry executives to investigate the feasibility here. There's just an inherent, basic, bottom line conflict of interest that I think I don't know how we surmount it.
Well, yeah. I think that there were 11 people appointed, and Deval Patrick appointed a group of them, and I think the mayor appointed some more, so he didn't appoint all 10. But yes, and how could this be that we're in a situation where Boston has become an official applicant before the USOC, and there has not been a vote in the state legislature for this, and there has not been a vote in the city council, and basically the democratic process has been thrown out the window. It's been forgotten about. How can that be? How did Boston become an official applicant in this case? Look, I think there's another side to the story which must come into the discussion, and that is whatever the cost is and whatever the private share of the cost would be. So maybe it's $15 billion, maybe it's 20, maybe it's 25, and maybe the private sector is 30%, maybe it's 40%, but whatever those numbers end up being, what is it that we're gaining by doing this?
I can answer that. Wait. Let me answer that. Here's what O'Connell said to me last night. It was the next thing I wanted to broach with you. I said the night before, I had Evan Horowitz on, who from the Globe has done a lot of work on this issue about the economic benefit, and he says it's negligible at best. He actually quotes you, I think, in part. And what O'Connell said to me last night, and these were his numbers, the economic impact in London was 100,000 jobs, 40,000 of which were permanent. Is that true?
No. No, it's not. I mean, look, what, it's not even close to true. And I wish we had a long time so I can go into great detail here. But the study that was done in London was done by a company that was hired by the Olympic Organizing Committee. And they said this company sent out a letter to get economists to work for them. And in the letter, they said, we're going to have to produce a study that shows great benefits because the London Organizing Committee is concerned about pushback since we're spending so much money. And they come out, they do a study with a very bogus methodology and inaccurate, unrealistic assumptions. And doing that, you can produce any numbers you want. But first of all, it's much too early to tell what the ultimate impact on the English economy will have been from those games. What we do know is that tourism revenue actually went down during the month of the Olympics. We do know that many of the promises that were made for the boroughs around Stratford, where the Olympic Stadium is in East London, have not come to fruition. And they can produce whatever numbers they want. I think Sebastian Coe did a wonderful job publicizing this, but it doesn't mean that those numbers are real numbers. Go back and you look at all of the other previous Olympics. They all have some economic impact study that says it was the cat's meow for the local economy. It generated employment. It did this. It did that. But the independent studies that have been done, based upon not ex-ante projections but ex-post looking at the actual data, say that these things don't pay off.
You know, but one of the things, in the piece you were quoted in that Mark Arsenal wrote a Sunday, I guess two Sundays ago, in which the basic contention is made by the sponsors, they're going to do a low-cost Olympics, and actually the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, which historically wants extravagance, is going to make an exception in this case because they've been so roundly criticized. All the bidders dropped out for the 2022 Winter
All
Games,
two,
other than
right.
Kazakhstan and China or some such
right.
some
exactly right.
Some such thing there. So is it not credible that this may be the outlier, that they can do it comparatively
no,
on the cheap?
Not credible. It's not credible. Well, by the way, and we're simplifying here because we have a time crunch.
Yeah.
But I could go back and talk about the 84 Olympics in Los Angeles or the 92 Summer Olympics in Barcelona.
The supposed
successes. And
there
are numbers very special. They're very special conditions that held in those circumstances, and they were successful. Those circumstances do not apply to Boston now. The IOC has been Thomas Bach, who wants to reform the process, and God bless him for it, does need reform. They've put out their proposals for reforming the process. And the only concrete thing they have that's going to reduce the price of the bid is that they're going to pay for seven people from the applicant cities to go to IOC meetings to make presentations. That's going to save the applicant city about $300,000 or $400,000 in a bid that normally costs $100 million, just for bidding.
So what is this?
If you lose the bid, you still pay the $100 million.
And so, Andrew Zimbalist, does this mean that every Summer Olympics forever is going to be in Abu Dhabi? I mean, what does this mean? I'm serious. For the future?
Well, look, I mean, ultimately what needs to happen is that the IOC has to come off of its pedestal, and they have to accept that there could be Olympic stadiums that don't have 80,000 capacity. Mm-hmm. They have to accept that they could have Olympic stadiums that are college track and field stadiums. The glory of the Olympics, after all, is that there's an international competition where countries that otherwise aren't getting along are competing with each other, and they're exciting athletic events. We don't need, the spectators don't need an 80,000 Olympic stadium. We can watch on television, we can have Bob Costas doing his broadcasting, if the stadium has only 2,000 seats in it. All the other stuff is frills where you have to pay obeisance to the all-powerful international monopoly, the IOC, And somehow that has to be taken care of.
Exactly. The Greeks all squeaked by with all this fancy stuff. Andrew
they were
Zimbalist,
naked,
didn't
too.
They? I mean, they did it. They did it on the cheap. I mean, the other thing here is that Massachusetts, as you know, because you're at Smith College, does not have a good reputation in terms of promising things from a political perspective and following through. We get taken for a ride over and over and over again. Let's not even talk about the big dig. How's the Rose Kennedy Greenway turning out? You know, that was supposed to be just this.
Not quite as attractive.
Exactly.
As it
seems in my experience, I hate to be cynical, but I am cynical because I've been a reporter for too long around here. This is going to fall apart. Everything falls apart.
But when, we also have to look beyond the costs here. We also have to look at how do we want our land to be used
exactly.
in Greater Boston? One of the things we did with the big dig, which was nice, I'm not sure it was worth $15 billion, but it was a good outcome, is that we buried concrete underground and we covered it with grass. If we do the Olympics, we're going to take grass and cover it with concrete because we're going to be building all of these 32 venues. We're going to be doing exactly the opposite. Our land in Greater Boston is scarce, and as our population grows over time and as we confront environmental challenges, it's going to become more and more precious. We build Olympic stadiums and Olympic venues. They're going to be there for decades and decades. Is that what we want to use our land for?
But,
no.
You know, Andrew Zimbalist, on that front, and I want to get before you go, I want to get back to the whole issue of the lack of transparency because it's something Marjorie and I have been discussing a lot. And actually, something Marty Walsh in our studio a couple of weeks ago acknowledged was a real serious problem here. Following your line of thinking, okay, so the construction types and the other business people who potentially could benefit from this, let's assume for argument's sake that that's part of their motivation. If you're right about what the future of Boston would look like during the process at the Olympics and after the Olympics in terms of economics, the grass being replaced by concrete, all that sort of stuff, why is Marty Walsh seem to be not quite all in yet? In fact, here's Marty Walsh yesterday. Let's hear what the mayor had to say, and then we'll follow up with it.
I think it would be a great opportunity for our city. I think it certainly put us on a worldwide stage, larger than we are today. But I've made it perfectly clear. I am not going to mortgage the future of the city away, or am I going to let whoever's mayor after me have to have a burden of having a price tag left over. I'm just not going to do that.
So why is he as positive as he is, despite his financial... Why is he so positive if you're right about everything, Andrew?
Well, how do politics in this country work?
Meaning what? That he's doing favors for his friends?
Very powerful interests.
Meaning that they're responsive to people who are going to support them financially. And construction companies are very big players in an urban political economy, enormously big players. Yeah. And construction unions are big players. So you can find a subset of the Boston economy and executives from that economy who want this to happen or are willing to fund you if you support it happening. It doesn't make it good for the economy.
Got it. Okay, so here's, I want to get back to...
And the last thing, too, it's not as if we are some podunk little city out in the middle of nowhere. I don't think we have to worry about being on the world stage. We may not be London.
But you and I have been discussing...
There's no evidence to support the world stage argument.
Yes,
you're on the world stage, but it doesn't mean that you're going to get more tourism. It hasn't played out that way elsewhere. It doesn't mean you're going to get more international trade and more investment. And in fact, there's a potential danger, because what happens if there's terrible, hot, humid weather during the Olympics that gets broadcast all around the world? What happens if there's terrorism during the Olympics? Is that going to promote Boston's image? It's not a foregone conclusion that being on the world stage is going to be positive, even on an image level, let alone for economic reasons.
You know, Andrew Zimbalist, last thing from me is this transparency thing, which you've talked a lot about. What put me over the edge, and I've probably been much more open-minded about this than most people in our media community have been, the bid was submitted on December 1st. It's not a when I had O'Connell on last night, we asked for a copy of the bid, and they say it's not a public document. I asked him about it last night, and he said there's proprietary information in it, a lot of stuff that competitors could use, so we can't disclose this. If we get picked in January as the United States, what do you call it, nominee or whatever,
right.
that goes to the International Olympic Committee, then we'll start disclosing things. Is this, whether it's right or wrong, and I find it to be really troubling because all this is being done in our name with our money, even if he's telling the truth and every single dollar of public money is already in the pipeline, whatever that means, it's still our tax dollars already in the pipeline. Is this typical, meaning that bids are so closely held and so secretive at this stage of the process and other historical bidding?
not quite to the same extent that it is in this case, that to the extent that there hasn't been more public discussion, that it hasn't been publicly vetted, that some of the information hasn't been released. I think this stands on one end of the spectrum in terms of lack of transparency.
Andrew Zimbalist, I think you should be nominated for the Pulitzer Prize here for your reporting.
I accept.
On this scam, because I do think it's a scam, and I would hate, and I really worry about, as someone who lives here, the city being ruined by these hulking white elephants that would be left here and the taking of all this land and people getting loaded again. You know, it's secrecy, Jim. It's not a good thing.
So you can tell, Andrew, that Marjorie's undecided at this particular
point. I'm undecided, that's right.
Hey, Andrew Zimbalist.
How do you really feel, Marjorie?
Before you go away, we want to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, Marjorie Egan went to Smith College.
I did.
And my daughter is now a senior, so it was a double pleasure to speak to you today, Andrew Zimbalist.
Wow,
thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on. My pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Very much.
Bye-bye.
Andrew Zimbalist, the sports economist and the Robert A. Woods Professor of Economics at Smith College. His latest book is Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. You can buy it on Amazon right now. In mid-January, you can buy it anywhere. We're going to get back to the Eric Garner case in just a few minutes. He, of course, is the gentleman who was killed in a chokehold by police. The Staten Island grand jury has not indicted. I'm going to talk about it again later in the show. First, we're going to talk to Alex Beam. If you think you knew everything about the Yule log, stick around. Alex has some explaining to do. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brady. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3, as he is every Thursday for Open Mic, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as Marjorie and I do every Thursday, remember what we said this morning up in the newsroom? Do you remember? You want me to say it?
You say it.
Okay, fine. We're marveling that his name is Alex Beam. I think it was Marjorie who was marveling, because like a sunbeam hairdryer, Marjorie said, his hot wit annihilates all that annoying static electricity in the air. Alex, great to see you.
Great, and if you have me in the bathtub, you'll be electrocuted and die.
Now, Marjorie said that, actually. I just didn't have time to mention
it.
It was
inevitable.
Quick. It's very quick.
That's something we can all look forward to.
So, so Alex Beam, say it ain't so. A contretemps involving slavery in Brookline public schools.
Hometown of Marjorie Egan, where all three
Brookline
of your kids went to school.
Do fill us in, please.
Well, was this successfully buried by the Globe? That's kind of my question. It ran in the West section. I sort of dug it out from the back of the West section. It's by James Burnett, obviously a frontline reporter.
Yes.
I read it online, so I don't know. You think it wasn't in the regular paper?
Yeah, no, because I get the so-called West Weekly, which is now down to once a week on Sunday, and it was like really buried, which I kind of didn't understand, right? Because it's a semi-interesting
Well, tell us the story. We'll ask Brian McGraw, your boss, about it next week. And we'll
ask him why he buries the good stuff and puts all the rubbish on
this. This is one of those visceral, hot-button kind of issues.
So what is the issue here,
I
Alex?
Sort of thought so. Well, I don't live in Brookline. But anyway, some guy named Brooks Ames, and I think that name is vaguely familiar from Brookline Town Meeting, but it's okay. I mean, he's expressing his First Amendment rights, saying, you know, they're using a textbook to teach American history in the Brookline system that is kind of equivocal on the subject of slavery. And then he directly quotes, and I see it's in front of you, so why don't you directly quote?
Well, this quote that I guess got everybody worked up is, quote, slaves were treated well or cruelly depending on their owners. Some planters took pride in being fair and kind to their slaves, close quote. Kind of a Gone with the Wind kind of deal going on there.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, Burnett does a wonderful job on this piece. I mean, I'm amazed they buried it so well.
No, you mentioned that a couple of times.
I'm going to mention a couple okay? I mean, it's a 2003 textbook that was apparently updated, and he says that this specific language was updated. However, I emailed Tyrone Howard at UCLA, the co-editor of this textbook, and asked him what the new language was, and I emailed him twice. He answered both times but didn't tell me.
By the way, Howard is an African-American, we should say, the guy who edited this
You
thing.
Just
yes.
said it,
yeah.
yeah.
Yes,
right.
Who defended the who original
did.
Language.
Defended the language and replied to me immediately, defended it to Burnett and said, I wonder why Brookline didn't come to me, you know, and asked me for a viable discussion of this language. Howard was totally, I want to do a column on this. I sort of backed away for various reasons. But, I mean, Howard says, look, it's African-American scholars. And he named John Hope Franklin. He named Henry Louis Gates. And he named a third guy whose name is escaping me.
So wait a second. What would your column say?
Well, I was going to loop it into the Silverglate Kamen or Huckleberry Finn thing about how
that guy from Auburn excised the words. The Is N-word. That what you're talking about? The guy
yeah,
who took the N-word out
at
of it.
Smith, yeah. At Smith College.
Oh, but the guy.
No, we're talking about something different.
Oh, okay.
Earlier this year, I mean, Kaminer was on this panel and used, talked about Huckleberry Finn
yes.
using the N-word. I was going to lump it all together in a column about, I mean, how, sort of about forbidden speech vis-a-vis the Civil War specifically. Although, to get back to the slavery thing, it's actually a little bit, it's more interesting, I would argue. And it seems weirdly unfair to kind of lash out against this guy, Brooks Ames. Probably that's why the story isn't in the main part of the Globe, because it's hung on a fairly slender reed. You know, one guy objecting.
But well, we should just to be clear that people understand that what would seem to upset this guy Ames is that there could be any sort of nuanced interpretation of slavery. He wanted it to be all evil, all horrible. And obviously it was evil and horrible. But this Howard guy seems to be saying that there were conflicted slave owners. So does it undercut the horror of the system by admitting that not everybody was gung-ho about
even
slavery?
Even though they participated in the
even
institution.
Even though they participated
right?
in it. So it's kind of a can you walk and chew gum at the same time kind of deal.
Well, I read the links he sent me. I mean, I actually was going to write about this because I have a kind of much larger weird theory about the need for revisionism where understanding of the Civil War is concerned. But all the links he sent me, you know, they were fairly simplistic. By the way, one was from one of, it might even been from GBH's own website. Obviously, you know, American Experience, blah, blah, blah. There's a huge kind of historical infrastructure hanging off a lot of public radio websites. And the axis that Howard is interested in, generally speaking, is the axis between slaves who worked in the home and slaves
yep.
who worked in the fields. And so apparently there's a kind of new consensus that and I hate to say it, but it's in the movie 20 Years a Slave. You know, there's
12
a new,
Years a Slave.
Excuse me, yeah, 12 Years a Slave, where there's sort of this new perceptive consensus that men and women who worked in the homes of the plantation owners were treated much better than the men and women who worked
One
in
last
fields.
Question yeah. about this. Surely. Was this in the Maine newspaper, or was it only in the West edition of the Okay.
I don't know. Why are we burying
now,
good stuff?
Hold on. We're burying your opinion here. So should Brookline have redacted this or not?
Which they ultimately did. Should
yeah,
they ever
that's
not?
A good point. No, of course not. I mean, the point I would have made in the column I didn't write that inevitably would have been buried by the Boston Globe is that, I mean, you know, we need to know more, not less. I mean,
yeah.
History is complex. There are nuances in history. There are ambiguities in history. Pathetically, the only example I can think of, again, goes to 12 Years a Slave, where Benedict Cumberbatch, if you remember, the story is purportedly from the guy's own memoir, was this kind of enlightened slave
yeah.
owner, okay? And it's interesting that that's in the movie. In any
the
case,
reason it's very hard to even have this discussion is if you haven't read the actual textbook, you don't know
yes.
the context in which from which the sentence comes. Isn't that a fair statement? I mean, how he speaks about slavery in general. Why are you making a face? No.
Because I respectfully disagree. I think Marjorie's closer. The point is that the takeaway from this article and the contretemps seems to be you can only say one thing about slavery, that it was hateful, horrible.
I think that you're right. That okay. is the – okay,
yeah.
fine.
And you
okay,
can't
now,
have any nuanced discussion of it.
Now, right. can we have a discussion about somebody who actually apparently could have written a positive book about slavery? That would be James Watts, who most of us know. Well, we know him for two reasons. We know him because he's a tad racist, but he was famous before being
okay.
a racist.
It's like being a tad pregnant.
He was the co-discoverer of DNA. What was it, in the 50s or whatever it is? He's selling his Nobel. It's the first one
yep.
it's ever been sold.
Yeah.
He's selling. Wait, second one?
I believe it's the second one in the Times story today, but I didn't triple check.
The thing I read.
The Nobel Prize of a deceased winner has been sold
for
$2.3 million to this Chinese billionaire. Yeah.
So this they're talking about $3.5 million here. He said he's broke,
nice
et cetera.
Payday.
But essentially, there's a dispute about whether or not he really needs the money or he's just saying, you know what, blank you. The people have been critical of him because he obviously has made a racist pronouncement here, too, and he's sort of been ostracized. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, and maybe he's nuts, right? He makes $300,000 a year. even as emeritus head of Cold Spring Research Institute. He seems to have plenty of
They
dough.
Fired him, but he's still the emeritus right. thing. They fired him because some of these racist comments.
He needs the money.
He wants to buy a David Hockney painting.
Yeah, frankly, for $3.5 million, I'm surprised more of these people aren't selling these paintings in their
Nobel
golden
Prize.
Years. I mean, not paintings, I'm sorry.
By the way, here's what he said that got him in trouble.
Medallion.
Amongst other things. This is
Racist Week on your show?
Sunday Times in 2007.
And by the way, slavery was fine.
He was inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa because all our social policies are based on the fact that their, meaning Africans, intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. And he goes on to say, people who have to deal with black employees find this not true. So is he generally seem to be disturbed or he's – no, I'm serious.
Yeah, no, I think
or
it's a serious –
Or an outright racist.
I mean, think it's a serious question. I remember as a kid reading his book, which was he solely authored, called The Double Helix, which is really one of the greatest books ever written about science. I mean, he is obviously something of a genius. I did want to casually mention he has a really kind of dark walk-on cameo role in Susanna Kaysen's memoir of, Girl Interrupted. It seems like he comes to McLean Hospital to attempt to put the moves on her. Anyway,
a good book.
I refer you to that very brief book. She calls him the man who discovered the secret of life.
You want to do a quiz? You want to answer a quiz question? What does he have in common with the Beatles that is not a positive attribute? In turn, this is vis-a-vis this co-discovery of the DNA thing.
He failed to credit a woman.
Exactly. The Beatles on their albums almost never, if ever, credit the players other than the four members of the band. If the other people played on the albums, they didn't get any credit on the liner notes. And this guy didn't credit the woman who apparently was critical to the discovery. No?
You know
that
why?
Seems like a really weird analogy.
It was
Maybe
a weird
you
analogy.
Maybe you want to edit
you.
That out before Friday because a lot of the Beatles. A lot of the Beatles side people weren't women, A. And then B, there's another weird fact.
No, it's about not giving credit to people who deserve it. Go ahead. It isn't about gender. Go ahead.
Whatever.
Whatever yourself.
No, there's a weird detail. I apologize for forgetting her name.
Rosemary something.
Yeah. There's a weird
detail. Rosalind. Is it Rosalind Franklin?
Rosalind Franklin.
That's
yeah.
her, yeah.
There's a weird detail in the Time story, though, that the Nobel can only be shared three ways.
Yeah. Oh, yes. We had this discussion on the air a couple of weeks ago, which is scandalous. We discussed with Karen Miller, I think. Was it Karen Miller? I think it was. That there were – it was a recent set of awardees where there were at least four, if not five people, who everybody agrees were equally involved in the discovery or the whatever it was, and only three of them got the prize. How ridiculous is that?
Yeah, no, it seems really strange. I mean, however, since this is a vaguely intelligent discussion, even if they had allowed the Nobel to be shared many ways, doubtless Rosalind would have been cut out anyway because of the position of female researchers.
Absolutely.
I just want to point out some of the fine descriptions of this guy that is in this piece in the State of the Universe by Laura Helmuth. She first calls him a peevish bigot, and then she discloses that his fellow faculty members at Harvard described him as the Caligula of biology.
I like that.
So
wow.
It doesn't get much better than that.
It's a reputation to live up to.
No, Alex.
Absolutely.
Alex, as you know, Marjorie is the Catholic spirituality columnist for CruxNow.com.
CruxNow.com.
But if you do
CruxNow.com.
But if you do
Everyone's going there.
If you do a survey of your recent columns, there's obviously some, I don't know, a passive-aggressive thing vis-a-vis Marjorie. Every one of your columns is about religion. Doesn't matter what
He's
it is.
He's after my job.
Buried exactly. in some religious place. But the thing that really captivated me is this whole thing about, was Jesus ever hitched to Mary the thing, this reluctant bridegroom? What was your point in this? What were you trying to say?
I really just wanted to vent, I saw a very excellent piece by a writer named Charlotte Allen in the American Spectator. She's actually been on this case for a long time. I had conveniently forgotten that the whole modern trope of Jesus was married and had a bunch of children we owe to Dan Brown.
Dan Brown, that's right.
Da Vinci
right.
Code for those who don't
know. And before that, The Last Temptation of Christ. The movie had Jesus fantasizing about his married life with Mary Magdalene.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't see it.
It's okay.
One of the worst movies of all time.
It was not.
Horrible. Oh, really?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well,
it was.
Horrible.
I don't know.
I mean,
the fact
Harvey Keitel playing Judas, it was great.
Go ahead.
He is Judas. Stop it. But no, I mean, it's a really – the point – I guess I wanted to make this really vulgar point, which is that these people, whom I called scholars in quotes, who doubtlessly will be filing their lawsuits before the sun sets, I mean, come on. It's always at Easter and Christmas they start plugging these fake, bogus books. And now, of course, I have to draw a very dark line between those fake scholars and Harvard's Karen King, the oldest endowed chair at Harvard College, you know, who came up with this, to me, totally spurious, you know, Gospel of Mary.
About a year or so ago, right?
Yeah, it's smaller than this notebook. I realize we're not on TV.
But you seem to be writing that it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not exactly into this part of it. Doesn't it matter?
Here's why that we don't want to have, especially if you're Catholic, you don't want to have Jesus married, because it ruins everything. If Jesus was married, then my God, the priests can all get married and the Pope can get married.
What do you mean it ruins everything?
Married.
It's exactly what you would like to be the outcome.
Yes, but from the hierarchy's perspective that this ruins everything. And the other thing is, I don't know why you can't, you think Jesus couldn't have had brothers and sisters? I mean, you think, you buy this idea that, okay, you could, that this woman who was probably
Seen you this agitated.
Well, because it's sort of crazy to think that a woman who maybe gave birth to Jesus at 13 or 14 years old never had another child. So your theory, Alex Beam, is that she was virginal her entire life? Is that your theory?
Well, she was certainly virginal when she gave birth to Jesus. We know that. I really wanted to lash out at these fakes, and
okay.
So I sort of did that. On a more serious note, I mean, there's only one book worth reading about about the historical Jesus. Obviously, it's Albert Schweitzer's book, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, which summarizes the entire 19th century German scholarship of the attempt to find out who Jesus actually was.
Who was he, Alex?
Albert Schweitzer?
No.
He was hoping you'd ask that
you
question.
You found out, you read the book, found out who Jesus was. Who was he?
He was who the Gospels say he was. I mean, that's where the whole German hermeneutic ends up. And in a way, I think the point I'm trying to make that I think I would never, ever successfully articulate is that that's the Jesus we got.
Yeah.
Okay, we got the Jesus of the four Gospels.
The unmarried one.
Yeah. There may or may not have been a Gospel of Mary. You know, it goes right directly to Elaine Pagels. You know, the Gnostic Gospels are definitely of considerable interest. And it is arguable, I think, and probably factual, that the anti-women church fathers of the 8th and 9th century kicked out a lot of Gnostic Gospels. I mean, blah, 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 blah. I mean, But for most of the world's billions of Christians, I mean, I think we should deal with this mythological Jesus. I'm a little bit more comfortable with that.
Okay, so Alex, if you remember, first of all, in our former radio lives, you were banned from our show for years, as you recall.
I'm so proud
of that. Insulting us over.
I'll get banned from this show, by the way.
No, we hope so. He regularly insulted us in his column or in anything he's writing, and he said there are my friends, but then he'd insult our show.
The tide has turned.
Essentially,
now I'm under the radar.
The only time we ever allowed you on was to discuss. You were sort of our correspondent for the World Cup, even though you didn't go to the World Cup. Now, the New England Revolution. You may or may not know this. The local team is playing in a championship game on Sunday. You aware of that fact?
I am, in fact.
Is that reason? What's the league called? Do you know what's the league called?
MLS.
Major League Soccer. Yeah. Is that reason for excitement? I'm serious about this thing. I mean, I know it's not World Cupian, but is it reason for excitement?
Yeah, why not? I mean, although I was listening to sports radio coming in here, and I must say it's still well below their radar. You know, the big deal, the big gains to get inside baseball in sports radio was like when they started talking about hockey, and that's how they kind of bumped their numbers up a few percentages. They certainly haven't started talking about soccer. Let's put it that way.
Who are they playing?
They're playing the David Beckham-less LA Galaxy.
Oh, they are? Where's that game?
Where is it?
Yeah,
it's a StubHub Stadium. What is this, the Friday News Quiz?
Where's StubHub Stadium?
It's there in L.A., in the vast expanse of L.A. Yeah, more importantly, it's at 3 p.m., so you can catch both games.
Are you going to watch it?
I'm not that. No.
What do you mean both games? What do you mean both games?
Well, you want to watch the Patriots at 8:30. That's a huge challenge going up against San Diego.
StubHub Stadium?
Yeah, come on. You're not going to make me lecture you because you did your own homework. It's one of these, you know, kind of politically appropriately sized soccer stadiums, you know, 26,000, the kind, of course, that Mr. Kraft wants to build right over there in South Boston, I believe. It's the whole new sort of mini-me stadium. It's a big thing that's sweeping the country. You build it because my nephew was at the at the semifinal in Gillette. And as you may know, you know, they create a fake stadium there. They don't sell out the top tier, blah, 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 blah. So it's stuff
that looks more full and there's a better feeling.
Right, right. And I looked at the numbers, you know, and it's weird. All the relatively successful MLS teams do get about between 20 and 22,000 average attendance, which is what these stadiums basically fit. I think Gillette fits 26,000 in the configuration, which they got for the semifinal.
And they signed this Jermaine Jones, that's his name, right? The guy that played for the World Cup team for the U.S., who's a star and since that time. You know, the problem with this, I don't want to dwell on this, but the problem with this
is... If you want to lose listeners, you might as well keep
semifinals. Do you know how ridiculous the system is in the MLS, where it's a combined goal total for two games? So if you win the first game 5-1, what's the point of the second game? The other team has to beat you by 5 goals.
Listen to you.
You're way ahead of me, but I got a news quiz for you.
What's that?
Okay, which famous soccer star's last game is this?
This one?
Yeah.
Which soccer star?
I like the way
you
said it.
I happen to know the answer to this.
Do you really?
Of course, Pele. It's his last game.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Who is it?
It's the man whose Homeric epithet is the overrated. Landon Donovan. It's the overrated.
Oh,
Landon.
The U.S. guy.
Yeah. What do you think? It's a trick question?
He plays for L.A.?
He plays for L.A. Galaxy.
Well, that's really sad. Yeah. Okay, so here's the moment you're here for. This is the weekly 45-second explainer. What happens is... Alex chooses a topic, either really complex or that is causing a lot of confusion, then he attempts to explain it clearly, relatively clearly, in 45 seconds or less. Now, you are going to explain, I'm told this week, is it called Bouche de Noël? Is that how you pronounce
Bouche
that?
Bouche de Noël.
That is exactly what I'm not going to be explaining.
Oh, what are you explaining?
But we might as well start the clock now because now we're disambiguating Bouche de Noël, which means Christmas mouth.
Okay, let's start the clock right now. Here you go. Go.
From Bouche de Noël.
Bouche.
This is like French one.
Do you remember when, this had to be ad-lib, when Steve, what's his name?
You're taking away his time,
No, what's the guy's name? Steve, the great comedian.
Steve Martin. Bouche.
When he plays Inspector Poirot, and he's trying, they're trying to teach him to
have
Hamburger. One of the funniest scenes of all. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Geez, I hope you're yielding back to me the unused time.
45,
yeah, thank you. It's not that interesting a subject, actually. Bouche de Noël.
What is it?
It means
it.
Well, bouche is French for log, so it means Yule log. But what the Bouche de Noël is a pastry. It turns out we could actually make it. It's actually very simple. You just create a kind of layer of sponge cake, and then you roll it around some cream, right? And so you create what looks like a log. It's rolled up, and you cut it, and you serve it, blah, blah, blah. That's called a Bouche de Noël. However, I know there's still time left.
Yeah.
The Yule log takes you back to the pagan origins, of course, of Christmas, which Revels does quite well. Obviously, it's a celebration of light because there's no light on December 22nd, and the Yule log was what the pagans burned. They made a huge Yule log bonfire to celebrate the returning of the light.
I did not know that.
You knew that.
I don't think I did.
Of Christianity is a complete fraud. That's why you scared who Jesus was. Because
okay,
it's all a pagan thing.
Is it Bouche?
Bouche de Noël.
Bouche de Noël.
I just want to be clear on the Jesus front. He had many brothers and sisters, okay? I want that on the record there.
We are his brothers and sisters.
Good to see you.
Oh,
really
we are
pleasure.
His brothers and sisters, okay.
Alex Beam.
Joyeux Noël.
The always quirky and a little bit peevish Alex Beam from the Boston Globe.
But not the Caligula of the Boston Globe.
No, he's not the Caligula of the Boston Globe. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. The latest book, American Crucifixion by Alex, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex, great to see you. We're going to talk about Eric Garner in just about about 10 minutes or so, I guess. But up next are environmental cousins, outer and inner space. WGBH's science editor Heather Goldstone joins us to discuss the diverging trends in the nature of ocean and space exploration. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. NASA is taking one of the biggest steps, apparently, in putting humans back into space with the proposed launch of the Orion crew capsule. It's not going today, apparently. It's going tomorrow, according to our guests. And at the same time, our ocean research fleet is shrinking. A lot of this has to do with funding. As Carl Sagan would say, billions and billions of dollars are spent on outer space research, whereas ocean research gets only millions and millions. Here with us in Studio 3 to discuss what she describes as the diverging nature of ocean and space exploration is GBH's science editor, Heather Goldstone. Heather is also an expert in ocean science. Hello there again, Heather.
Good to be here.
So this is obviously a problem, or is it not a problem, this lack of funding for one and more funding for the other?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on which side of the aisle you're sitting on, right? I mean, this is for those who are really gung-ho about human exploration of space, a human presence in space, then obviously what we've seen in the past few years has been, well, the shutdown of the shuttle program, but a reinvigoration of the idea of a human presence in deep space, going beyond the moon, potentially even to Mars by, you know, 2030s, 2040, looking at trying to actually land humans on Mars. And that takes a lot of money.
And that's what this Orion thing is a prelude to. Is that
right? Not, right? So this is and it's kind of funny because in some ways it's like a very retro thing where it's almost like we've gone back to the Apollo days. Doesn't look anything like the space shuttle. So the Orion crew capsule is literally like it looks like Apollo, but it's 30% bigger. And of course, all the computers that are inside and all the equipment that's inside is 40 years more advanced than Apollo was. So it's not just Apollo all over again, but it's this little kind of conical crew capsule that sits on top of a really big rocket. And there are no people going up in the test launch this week, assuming it manages to go tomorrow. This morning, they had a 2-hour and 40-minute launch window. And during that time, they had a lot of gusting winds and then actually encountered a technical problem with a fuel valve that they weren't able to fix in time. So they've delayed it 24 hours. And this would be unmanned. It's purely just to go up and test that they can, with the rocket that they're using at this point, which is not what they will be using for the longer term. This is the only time that Orion will go up on these particular rockets, but that they can get it up there, that all of the different parts of it can separate as they need to, and then that Orion can come down, launch its parachute, and that the heat shields hold up. Because this thing's going to be coming down at 20,000 miles per hour.
Wow.
And being bigger than Apollo was, it's going to be it's going to be heavier. It's going to be getting hotter. And so there's been a lot work done in re-engineering the heat shields on this as well.
Why do we want to go to Mars again? I mean, it's very exciting. And no, I'm serious. The concept of watching your television and seeing someone, except for those who are deniers, of seeing a man or a woman alight from an Orion kind of thing and put his or her foot on the Mars would be pretty exciting. But why is that of value to us?
Well, I mean, that's really at the heart of an ongoing debate in both ocean science and space science that's always been there, which is how much is it worth to actually have a human being there, not just looking at it with their eyes through a computer screen, through the eyes of a camera that's actually there, and not just directing a robot, but actually physically there. And there are some arguments for what humans can do scientifically and observationally with our brains being able to respond to something unexpected in a way that no robot, at least at this point, can. But I think with a lot of the space exploration, there's also a major aspirational aspect to it that's literally just, as you were saying, the excitement and the inspiration that comes from seeing what we can do.
Like John Kennedy's challenge.
Because
it's
there.
60s, right.
Right, yeah. This is the, you know, the 2000s version of the original space challenge. And it's basically that same old, you know, like climbing Everest, because it's there.
But
can we do it?
You also think, I mean, I get the because it's there thing. But also, with all these problems we're talking about with climate change, it certainly seems more practical to be doing more stuff right here on the Earth in the deep oceans to figure out how we can, you know, further forestall this or what we can learn. I mean,
you know, you're preaching to the choir here. But certainly, I mean, ocean scientists are saying we need more. That yes, ocean science is expensive, but when you put it in the context of space science, you know, NASA has a budget of $18 billion every year. This launch of Orion this week, NASA's estimate for how much that costs is $370 million. And that doesn't include the Orion capsule. That doesn't include technologies that might have been developed along the way that help this out but can also be used elsewhere. They don't count those costs in the costs of this launch. So $370 million for this launch this week. The entire ocean science budget is $360 million.
Wow.
So wait, I'm assuming, knowing nothing about science, and I think you've learned that that fact is true.
Yeah, me neither.
Based upon our discussions, we actually have learned a lot from you, though, which is one of the fun parts of this. I'm assuming it's because we can see things that happen in space. We were able to see, was it Armstrong who did one small step?
Yeah, but I would argue the same thing happens with ocean science. Think back a couple of years. James Cameron.
Yes.
Oh,
you know, his bright
point.
Green one-man
yes.
sub
Titanic,
that went to the deepest part of the ocean, right?
Great.
And the same argument was made with that one. I mean, James Cameron actually did put together an excellent, by all accounts, science team. He was working with a lot of excellent scientists and was making sure that what he was doing was not just a media stunt. But at the same time, every ocean scientist that I talked to after that event, you know, and I'd go say, okay, so it's great that somebody went back to the deepest part of the ocean, because there had been three people who had gone 40, 50 years ago. It was the first time, it's kind of like going back to the moon. It was the first time that somebody had gone back to the deepest point in the ocean.
How deep is the deepest point? Where is
it? You're going to put me on the spot and I'm not going to be able to remember the exact depth.
Roughly.
But we're talking about kilometers of depth at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. This is a completely dark and...
Where's the Mariana Trench?
It's off the west coast. It's in the Pacific, off the west coast
okay.
of the U.S. And so this, you know, deep, potentially kind of desolate, is it even able to have life down there? When there's definitely life around hydrothermal vents, these areas in the bottom of the ocean where you've got basically volcanic fluid coming up and you get these really warm, chemical-rich areas where there's a lot of life. But is there life anywhere else on the bottom of the ocean in this deep, the pressure constraints? And so he was down there looking around and actually doing some real science. But I went to these ocean scientists afterward and said, okay, so does it kind of suck that it was, you know, James Cameron
yeah.
and not a scientist who went down there? And like, and they said, no, it was great that he did some real science. But here was this high profile person and this high profile thing that could do exactly what putting a man on the moon could do. Get people incredibly excited about putting people on the bottom of the ocean as well as putting people,
So if my first analysis was wrong, then my second analysis must be right, that the lobbyists for the companies who make money from space exploration are more powerful, I mean this sincerely, than the lobbyists for the companies who make money off ocean exploration. If that's not right, then what is the reason for the huge disparity in funding?
You know, that's a really good question. And maybe some of it is a lobbying effort. Maybe some of it is just history, you know, that we do have this history of space exploration as a national and nationwide unifying effort. You know, it was the space race. It was against another country. And then we can draw on that history to say, okay, let's reinvigorate that and do that again. And other science fields have tried that same sort of thing. I mean, definitely as the Human Genome Project was getting started, there was a thought that we could try to build that in some ways as this other new frontier of trying to understand humans and at the smallest possible, most basic scale, and that would be completely eye-opening and wonderful and build that as kind of the next challenge like a space race. And it didn't really take off, I think, in the public eye that way at all. But I think there's potential for ocean science to do that.
You know what I wonder? How do we stack up vis-a-vis other countries on ocean exploration?
Oh, well, we stack up quite well. I mean, we have still a very large research fleet. We are one of the largest countries. We have certainly our largest manned submarine, Alvin, which can go the deepest of any of the submarines we have in the United States, is not the only one. There are others. There are a handful of others that have similar capabilities to Alvin. So we're not alone in that. But no, I'd say we stack up pretty well.
But do you not find it ridiculous? When you just said a minute ago that one of the things that Cameron was hoping to find out was what kind of life, if any, exists other than these events
yeah,
you
what
talked
does
about.
Exist?
How do we not know? In 2014, how do we know so little about our own planet? I mean,
that I think is the real question, right? That's the argument for putting more focus on the ocean, perhaps, than space, is that this is our own planet. And I'm not the first. I heard you guys, you know, using the term inner space. I'm certainly not the first one to use that. That's a term that ocean scientists do use to emphasize the fact that this is a final frontier that we know less about. We have. In terms of maps, anyway, we have better maps of the surface of Mars than we have of the bottom of the ocean.
That is unbelievable.
And if you figure that the oceans cover 70% of our planet, that kind of means we have better maps of Mars than we have of our own planet. But it's because it's so hard to get there.
What did he find, Cameron, when he went down and looked at what was at the
bottom? That it was
Leonardo
kind of
DiCaprio was
dark.
Actually down there. Do you know that he's swimming by?
things called bacterial mats, which don't sound very exciting. Basically clumps of bacteria. There are some other things he found. I mean, one question that has been kind of an interesting question that's definitely not fully answered at this point is there's this idea that there's a set depth limit below which it's physically impossible for fish to live because of the pressure. And so trying to figure out as you're, you know, gradually going down, can you see a fish down that deep? But then you also get into these other issues of, well, if there's not a lot of food to eat, you're not going to see a fish there, even if it's possible. So just if you don't see one,
no
it doesn't
light.
Mean they
so
can't.
Is
you know,
that
so
what
these
it is?
Not,
there's no food because there's no light? Is that?
There's no light, right?
Okay. How deep is it below which you don't normally see fish? I mean, again, you know, just ballpark.
Oh, I can't remember the exact number.
Is it a couple of miles or? Like,
oh, it's in the... I want to say it's around 800 meters, but
800
I'm not
meters.
Sure.
That's not
really?
That. That's not
sure
that deep.
That. No, it's got to be deeper than that because I know there are fish at some of the hydrothermal vents. So now, I can't remember the exact depth of that.
And this trench that you talked about off the California coast, this is just from what? From the Earth's plates moving, or we just don't know?
Yeah, no. I mean, there are trenches and mountains all over the bottom of the ocean.
I find that
I mean,
fascinating.
Do you remember? So the
so
whole
I,
you know the whole thing about
so
the state of our maps of the bottom of the ocean. You may remember a few years ago there was actually a Navy sub that hit an undersea mountain.
Wow!
They weren't working with the most up to date maps. Apparently, that undersea mount was apparently known to some government agencies, but they didn't have that map there. So yeah, I mean there are these large mountains, and it's constantly changing, right? Because it's not like our planet is fully formed and just sitting here static the way it's been for all time. We still have volcanoes. We still have all of the tectonic plates are shifting. That's what causes the hydrothermal vents in the ocean, causes volcanoes and earthquakes. And so it's constantly changing, and it's really difficult to literally keep an eye on all of that expanse of the bottom of the ocean.
Would you like to go on one of those submarines, Jim?
I'd be a little nervous, but I'd be very interested in the visuals from that is really
exciting. I love watching the robots that go to the bottom, but I have to say I'm with you on that one, Jim. I used to think I really wanted to go down in Alvin, and I'm not sure actually I could take it mentally, the idea that it's going to be 12 hours till you see the light again.
So one last quick thing. The story that we have here about the Neil Armstrong, this new research ship that was just christened actually earlier this year, that's a positive sign. I mean, there are...
Well, it is. I mean, it's yes and no. I mean, it's definitely a positive sign that we are seeing the United States research fleet being modernized and renewed a bit. But you also have to take it in light of the fact that the research fleet used to be more than 30 boats 10 or so years ago. By the end of this year, with the retirements that are happening and expected, it's going to be down to 18. And... say the Armstrong, as an example, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution will be taking over operation of that ship. They had one ship retire yesterday and another that retired 3 years ago. And in place of those two, they're getting one that's intermediate in size. So it's not as large. We're losing some of the what are called global class ships, the ships that could literally go anywhere in the ocean that can go out for months at a time. They're being replaced in general with slightly smaller ships that have a larger focus on robotics, which gets us back to that whole question originally, right? How important is it to have humans out there? And partly as a result of the way science is being done and the advances in robotics and what robotics can do for us in terms of bang for the buck and of just being able to lay eyes and instruments on parts of the ocean, a lot of ocean science is moving towards this robotics. But that also does mean that in some cases we're losing a little bit of that capacity to put humans out there.
Heather, thanks for being with us. You're going to be on tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston as well, correct?
Indeed.
Okay. Heather Goldstone is WGBH's science editor. She's going to be, as she just said, on tonight at 7 o'clock in Greater Boston. She's also an expert in ocean science as well as being our science editor. Great to talk to you, as always, Heather. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the death of Eric Garner and the failure of our judicial system, the failure of law enforcement, as well as race in America. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You all know this now. Yesterday, a Staten Island grand jury decided to not charge a police officer with any crime, even though his chokehold killed Eric Garner, a 43-year-old man who was allegedly selling loose cigarettes. That was his crime on the streets of Staten Island. The decision, not surprisingly, touched off a wave of emotion.
No, I don't accept his apology. No, I could care less about his condolences. No, I could care less. He's still working. He's still getting a paycheck. He's still feeding his kids. And my husband is 6 feet under.
How could we put our trust in the justice system when they fail us like this?
Not just a black problem or a brown problem or a Native American problem. This is an American problem. When anybody in this country is not being treated equally under the law, that's a problem.
It's a very hard thing to spend time trying to comfort someone you know is beyond the reach of comfort because of what he's been through. I can only imagine. Couldn't help but immediately think what it would mean to me to lose Dante. Life could never be the same thereafter, and I could feel how it will never be whole again. Things will never be whole again for Mr. Garner.
Most frightening part of it ends with Eric Garner saying
awful.
Repeatedly, I cannot breathe. If you didn't recognize some of those voices, the wife, the mother of Eric Garner, obviously the president, followed by the mayor of New York City, de Blasio. Our number is 877-301-8970. I know people want to talk about their reaction to this, about what can be done, what should be done. As Marjorie and I said earlier today, I think you can make a credible case that, well, both Marjorie and I think, thought the along with the governor of the Commonwealth, that a wise move in Missouri would have been to indict and allow a public trial and jury to decide the fate of Darrell Wilson. It is very hard to watch his video as many times as I think virtually every American has and say that that police officer, Pantaleo, committed no crime. You may say, well, maybe it wasn't murder, maybe it wasn't first degree, maybe it wasn't even second degree, maybe it was involuntary, maybe it was assault, maybe it was aggravated assault, but ultimately the grand jury there, and all you need is a majority. Unlike Missouri, where you needed three quarters of the grand jury, here all you needed was a majority of the 23 members of the grand jury to vote to indict for something. And absolutely nothing, as you know, was done. There were protests in New York City and around the country. And this all happened, by the way, in a horrible and cruel irony on the exact same day that 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was also a young black boy shot by a white cop in Cleveland, you know that story as well, was buried in just days after the failure to indict the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, 877-301-8970. What's your reaction? Can anybody make a credible case anymore other than Peter King, a congressperson from New York State, that race is not an issue in this policing? 877-301-8970. That's one of the worst videos I have actually ever seen. I mean, really, you're watching
well,
him
you
be
see,
killed.
Exactly. And you're seeing him, and I'm sure he was in a panic state, not being able to breathe. I mean, I can't even imagine what's that like. But a couple of things I just want to mention before we get to the telephones. There was a lot of talking in Ferguson about there being not sufficient police training, but that was Ferguson, Missouri. Now we're talking about New York City, which is a big city where you expect, you know,
the most sophisticated stuff.
Bill Bratton, who's the commissioner there, used to be the commissioner here. He was commissioner out in, I believe,
Los Angeles.
As well. So he's a seasoned policeman. He knows a very smart guy. That's one thing. And number two, you know, I'm not sure and whether we kept records that well, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s about this kind of thing. But there has been since 9/11 and well-deserved. I mean, 300-some firefighters were killed in New York City, police officers killed in New York City in the disaster of the World Trade Towers coming down. But there's almost been a political reluctance, I mean, to at all criticize cops since then. I think that idea has changed a little bit. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, when there were anti-Vietnam rallies, there was always, you know, it was a little bit too much hostility toward the cops, but there was this, there was a different kind of attitude toward the cops. Since 9/11, we've had this change in attitude, a political change in attitude, where we always talk about first responders, first responders, first responders. Mm-hmm. There's also been this militarization of the police, which Barack Obama's talked about, with all this equipment, this military-style equipment that the police are getting to fight terrorism, which in little tiny towns is kind of ridiculous. So I can't help but think that combined with the court decisions, which have made it easier, which have given more rights to police in terms of the force they use, all these things have kind of combined together to make things much more dangerous to be out on the street face-to-face with a police officer in some of the tough neighborhoods in the United States.
I agree with that, and I've read some of the decisions. You mentioned the op-ed that Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, wrote about how the laws have been changed by the Supreme Court, interpretation of the laws that make it much more difficult to indict a police officer for excessive force. None of those cases precluded an indictment for something. In this case, none of them. I mean, again, all you have to do is watch it. And, you know, by the way, for those who we're getting a lot of Facebook postings saying so much for the notion that cameras on cops are going to make a difference. Well, in this case, it wasn't a camera on a cop. It was a camera on a friend of Eric Garner. And while you might say it didn't make a difference in terms of there being justice for Garner's family, and obviously that's true because there was no indictment, I think it was a huge contribution because we actually got to see this. And it is very hard, other than, again, I hate to keep quoting him, but he's the one who said it. Other than Peter King, who praised the decision, again, a member of Congress from New York State, and went on to say, which I find to be absolutely, even if you believe this, as uncaring and cruel as possible. Well, if he couldn't breathe, as he said 10 times, then he couldn't have spoken the words, "I can't breathe," is what Peter King says. There's almost nobody with whom you speak. I mentioned Jeffrey Toobin last night. Toobin, who I'm a huge fan of, who's on CNN, who's their lawyer,
he's
legal
great.
Analyst, and he's totally fair and plays it down the middle. He actually said last night, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, I'm usually the guy who plays down the middle. I'm usually the moderate guy. There is no argument for no indictment on anything in this case based upon that video. And I think he is totally right, and it is very hard for people to continue to deny that race plays a factor. Before we get to your calls, I'll read again, I thought, an excellent segment of a terrific Globe editorial today about this, which mentions some polling data, a Washington Post ABC poll. 85% of African Americans, 61% of Hispanics disapproved of the grand jury's non-indictment of Darren Wilson, obviously out there in Michael Brown in Ferguson. Only 35% of white Americans disapproved. And they go on to say, which I think is the question everybody should ask themselves, all white Americans should, a serious self-examination would challenge white Americans to consider whether police homicide would be justified if the victim were a blonde, blue-eyed 12-year-old with a BB gun, obviously referring to Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black kid in Cleveland, a white teen stealing cigars, as Brown allegedly did, or a white man selling loose cigarettes, as did Eric Garner before he was choked to death in New York City. And again, allegedly selling illegally individual cigarettes for which he ends up getting the death penalty. I mean, that is the bottom line.
Yeah, and we're getting emails from people saying, I'm white and I was hassled by the cops and all that. I'm not saying you don't get hassled by the cops when you're white. No one is saying that. But the statistics are pretty clear that you are much more likely to be shot and killed by the police if you're black than if you are
white. Well, not just shot and killed. The Civil Liberties Union report that came out in Boston, while there's a big dispute as to whether or not it shows bias, and the Civil Liberties Union was saying yes a couple of weeks ago, the authors of the report and the police commissioner say no. But the police commissioner himself will admit it shows a disparity. Young, black, and Hispanic men are stopped much more frequently than our white, young white men. Those are the facts.
It was not long ago. We remember the Charles Stewart case, which was in the mid-90s in Boston, when the police, and it was a very different police department then, so I'm not saying that this would happen now, but the police department was basically going through Mission Hill and practically strip searching young black men looking for a suspect who, it turns out, was not a great guy, but he had nothing to do with the murder
Willie
of Carol DeMatteis Stewart, who was the wife of Charles Stewart. As people remember, that Charles Stewart shot his wife in the head after leaving a birthing class at the Brigham Women's Hospital. Anyway, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Robert from Winchester. What do you think, Robert?
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi there,
Hi.
Robert.
First of all, let me say, I think in the case of Michael Brown, and it's even more outrageous outrageous and obvious case in New York City that, you know, there's lethal negligence involved. I don't know why the other policemen who were at the scene in Staten Island also haven't been, I don't know if they've been disciplined for the lack of following procedure. But my point is this. I keep hearing everyone talk about, you know, these officers should be indicted and charged in criminal court. And there's something about that arena that, I don't know, doesn't seem right to me. I mean, if you take the military, if the soldier, you know, abuses his, you know, position and authority and violates the rules, he goes to a tribunal, and sometimes there is a, you know, he can be sentenced, he can do time. I think, like, an officer who has gone to work and screwed up in a lethal manner, it doesn't feel right to me about criminal court.
Why? Why?
Because the officer, I mean, if an officer is on duty and, for instance, ambushes someone to shoot them, that's a crime. An officer doing his job badly, negligently, and incorrectly with fatal consequences, I think he belongs in front of a different arena, not in criminal court. Because, first of all, how could you get first degree murder charge for someone who was at work? Clearly wasn't.
Well, first, yeah, Robert, let me say two things. One, there is an internal investigation. Bill Bratton, who Marjorie mentioned a minute ago, is the police commissioner, says there is an investigation of these cops that may lead to their suspension or firing. How can you end up with a criminal indictment, even though we didn't in these cases? You do it if a crime is committed. And with all due respect to you, Robert, if you watch his video and say just because these cops were on duty that they didn't cross a line and use excessive force, even if it doesn't rise to the level of first-degree murder, then I think you're watching a different video. The guy did nothing.
It's the government. It's the government. If you have a politician doing bad things, you know, the taxpayers are paying these people's salaries, electing these people if they're politicians to office. If government officials do bad things, it's important to have an open system. And heaven knows that the cops were trying people internally. You know, there's internal affairs investigations all the time.
Right, but you can't.
Do you trust internal affairs investigations? I think it's the fox guarding the chicken. You have to have openness and public
which
hearings.
Is why you should have a trial.
And I also think, you know, remember, you know, people get very would have gotten very upset, I'm sure, if there were in this case, if this ever got to a trial, if there was an acquittal. But at least you would have said, hey, we had a jury of 12 people. They heard all the evidence. They were in court every day. You could, which is why we should be able to watch these things on TV.
And you heard
watch
all the
them
evidence,
on TV,
right.
And you would know it's very different, you know, when you're actually there. Anyway.
Robert, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. By the way, if you're checking the news on your phone or something and saying, wait a second, that little kid you keep talking about, Tamir Rice, who was killed, the 12-year-old, just a handful of days ago on November 22nd, the attorney general has already found a civil rights violation. It's actually a different case out of Cleveland. The attorney general is holding a press conference as we speak, has found the use of excessive force by Cleveland police. It is not in this case. It's in a case of a couple of years ago. And I assume the timing of this, and this is pure speculation on my part, is to show to America that in appropriate cases, the Department of Justice will, in fact, find civil rights violations and maybe create some hope in some people.
KK from Cambridge, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey there.
Hi there.
Hi.
Listen, I think that in both instances, the police in Ferguson in New York escalated the situation to where it didn't need to go. In the instance of the Ferguson young man, why did the policeman not sit back in his and call up? It's not as though the kid was armed, and he claims he didn't know the kid had stolen anything. So they were jaywalking, and they were teenagers. And nobody will ever convince me that those kids turned on that policeman, that particular kid, unless he was incited. We'll never know that, because he's...
Hey, you know, KK, we're going to put you on hold for 1 second because you keep cutting out. Don't go away. We'll put you on hold. We'll take a call, and then you'll be the next after that. But we lose every other word that you're speaking. Jerry, you're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jerry.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for the call.
Hey, first of all, the police, in my opinion, they have, like, a permanent chip on their shoulder. And if you question any kind of anything from them, you're looked at as an enemy, and they're already in defensive mode trying to basically take you down, whatever that means in whatever situation. In Eric Gardner's situation, him defying, you know, please leave me alone. Hey, I don't want to deal with this. What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you're defying our authority. You have to be choked. And at one point, they had him on the ground. What, you have control of the situation. There's five of these guys. You mean to tell me at that point you couldn't stop choking him and make the proper arrest? But that chip, the ego was bruised. The ego was bruised. And how dare you bruise my ego, my blue authority ego here, and question my authority and question why I'm even asking you about this stuff. How dare you? So therefore, you must die. Sad to say. Same thing with Michael Brown. Yeah, maybe Michael Brown did punch the guy in the face. You know, on Facebook I've seen he was allegedly bruised. He didn't look too much like a big bruise to me. But his ego, again, the blue ego was bruised. He has to go down. Six shots instead of one in the leg to arrest him, you know, like in Kojak years ago.
Actually, 12 shots. 12 shots, six or seven that ended up hitting him. You know, KK, since you mentioned this behavior, we should...
I'm actually Jerry, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jerry. My apologies. Jerry, you know, just stay there for a second. Part of the words, if people haven't listened to the language and only seen the visual, here's what Garner said. Every time you see me, you want to mess with me. I'm tired of it. It stops today. Why would you? Everyone standing here will tell you I didn't do nothing. I didn't sell nothing, because every time you see me, you want to harass me. Selling cigarettes. I'm minding my business. Please, he says, please just leave me alone. I told you last time, please just leave me alone. And by the way, there is no physical resistance whatsoever. He is just in words, as you described, Jerry, saying, please don't do this. Don't do this anymore. You're harassing me. That's the extent of the quote, resistance that led to his death, which I think you described, Jerry, terribly well. Jerry, thanks for the call. And by the way, that's really, you know, it gets back to the camera thing. Can you imagine the story that would have been told about the resistance and why they had to subdue him and all this sort of thing had there not been a camera there? So I don't think this undercuts the case for the camera that Obama's making
money.
It underlines the case
simple.
For it.
It's not going to solve every problem, but it can certainly help. And in the couple of towns where they've had it, at least one town has statistics that it really didn't decrease the numbers of complaints about police harassment. So that's a pretty good track record. Matthew?
Well, we're actually going to try KK one more time.
Remember,
put
KK,
her on hold.
I'm
Let's
sorry.
Try KK
Hi,
again
KK.
To see if it's any better. Hi.
Hi there. Is this better?
So far, I think so. Go ahead.
So what I was saying is that the police in both instances, in Ferguson and in New York, escalated the situation. There was no need to, rather than defuse it. Mm. These two kids in Ferguson were jaywalking, right? And so because they were in the middle of the road.
We don't know what they were doing.
No, but the police officer himself said they were walking in the middle of the street, and without getting out of the car, which experts say he should have done, he says
right.
them, get out of the middle of the street, walk on the sidewalk.
Right. They were jaywalking when you're in the street when you're not supposed to be. You're jaywalking. So then get out of the street, blah, 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 right? So how did it get to that level? He must have done something to provoke that kid. There's no I have the mother of two black children who have thousands of black friends. I tell you, there's no way that kid would have ever punched him unless maybe he hit them with the car door. But we only know his side because the kid is dead, right? And he got in there, and of course he wasn't going to make himself look bad in the grand jury. So I can't believe a word he said.
Yeah, but KK, in the case of Michael Brown, there is at least a credible dispute, even though I probably end up where you do. There is no dispute in terms of Eric Garner. It's the cleanest case there could possibly be, even if he was guilty of the horrible crime of selling Lucy's in Staten Island. There was no resistance. There was, as Jerry just said, there was an attempt to say, please don't do this anymore. Please don't harass me. Let me be. And as a Facebook poster said earlier this morning, give him a ticket. Hand him a ticket or a summons that he go to court. Why did this get to this level to begin with? Which I guess is the point you're making.
Police escalate these things to the point, and then they show muscle where they don't need to. That poor man, of course he was gasping, saying, oh my God, I can't breathe. Who says you? It's absurd. Here again, we have police escalating situations to the level they don't need to. They should defuse things.
I agree.
Police
KK, we got it. We agree with you, and that is their job. And I think most cops who are listening or would call would say that's exactly what their job is, to defuse.
Matthew from Auburn. Hi, Matthew.
Hello, Matthew.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much for covering this.
Thank you.
What I'd like to say, too, is, you know, a lot of the rhetoric around the anti-police brutality has been body cameras on police officers, like you actually brought up not long before I was listening in. But we have instances here where you have the camera on the scene where you see Eric Garner getting choked. There's still no indictment for the officer involved in that case. Regarding Michael Brown, even though there was no police officer present, I mean, no camera present, there was evidence from both autopsies saying that Michael Brown had been shot 7 times. Regardless of the situation, whether Michael Brown stole from that store or not, I think it's important to mention that there's no need to ever shoot someone 7 times. There's evidence in both cases that are just being used, that aren't being used, and it shows a deeper flaw in the system, that it is about race, and that Robert McCulloch probably didn't try hard enough in his prosecution to get an indictment.
Well, I think that's conventional wisdom.
Yeah, I think the conventional wisdom is, and Matthew, thank you for the call, that prosecutors usually can get indictments because they're presenting a one-sided version of events. I mean, there were two sides presented in the Michael Brown case. Some witnesses said it was as Brown defenders said. Some people said it was as the police officer's defender said. But the point is, they can usually get convictions, indictments, and that's what's so weird in these cases that. You know, the old ham sandwich thing, which I've said a million times.
Yeah, I'm so sick of it. Not from you, but everybody. Well, but everybody knows that if a prosecutor wants an indictment, yes. There'll be an indictment. And that doesn't mean that the defendant isn't treated fairly, because the defendant has an opportunity. There's a presumption of innocence. The federal government has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The threshold, the probable cause threshold to have an indictment out of a grand jury is far lower than it is in a trial. You get an opportunity to defend yourself, and the public gets an opportunity, unless it's in federal court, of course, to actually see the prosecution.
Right, and that's another disgrace, too, but I'm not going to get off on that tangent, but that you cannot see federal trials. The Tsarnaev trial, if there is a trial, we won't be able to see that.
Unless
the government, right. Once again, has decided they don't want to have cameras in the courtroom, and I think there's much too much government secrecy, period. As you know, it's one of my constant themes. Anyway, Morgan from Wendell?
Hi, Morgan.
Where's
Hi.
Wendell?
Yes, Wendell.
Where?
Out by Greenfield.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I should have known that.
So should I. Hi, Morgan.
Well, there's only 800 of us.
Oh, wow.
It's good to meet one of you. Go ahead, Morgan.
Okay. I'm saying I don't want to, you know, completely poo-poo the racial aspect of this, but I think it's really important to note that these people that are dying are Americans. It's not like the police are doing this to somebody else. They're doing it to us.
And your point is what?
My point is that everybody should be outraged about this. It's not something that, you know, I keep hearing people say, oh, it's terrible what the police are doing to these poor black people. And it is, but it's also terrible what the police are doing to our fellow Americans. And we should all be outraged by this. I think the security apparatus in this country, from the NSA down to Barney Fife, is just completely out of control. And the courts have become accomplices to the powers that be. They're not on our side. Nobody's on our side anymore. We're living in a police state here, I think, more and more.
Well, you know, Wendell, Morgan from Wendell. I'm sorry, Morgan from Wendell. I mean, it is one of the themes that we talk about a lot is that you know, the power of the government is incredibly, it's just huge. And that if you're, Joe Blow caught in the vices, especially the federal government, if they want to pursue you for some kind of crime, I think it is out of control. And I think it's disgraceful what's going on right here in Boston over and over again with people being caught in the crosshairs of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And people, but you know what? People do not get very upset about it.
Well, they're upset. It's interesting you say that, Morgan. Thanks for the call. What I was going to say to you was, I think the level of upset is fairly universal and fairly high until the next major event. If a plane went down, if Malaysia airline, whatever, went down tomorrow, and CNN and Fox and MSNBC shifted their focus to that, would this fizzle? Is it staying alive because essentially the media has helped keep it alive?
I guess what I'm saying is that we have become very complacent, and that it doesn't bother people that the government routinely, right here in Massachusetts, very blue state Massachusetts, that the government repeatedly tells reporters or regular people that they cannot get information that they are entitled to. I mean,
But aren't you part of the problem? I mean, you and I have had NSA debates since the Edward Snowden thing broke. You're much more accepting. Your argument, if I may characterize it, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, is, listen, the credit card companies have all this information on us. Get over it. The genie is out of the bottle.
Well, that's slightly different. I mean, I think the fact that they did this is terrible, but I think the fact that we can be putting everything online on our telephones and on our computers and expect privacy is kind of ridiculous. But the idea that the government does this and the government hides things and that they have these secret grand jury proceedings and they have secret trials, which essentially is what they do in these cases in the federal government, because you can't see the – you can't.
Well, you can go, and the press is able to go. I know you can't get – believe me, I'm totally on your side. The fact that they're not television cameras, you know, I feel as strongly as you do. And by the way, that's one of the reforms, the whole grand jury thing. You know, the president has allegedly in 90 days ordered his task force that he talked about on Monday to come up with all these recommendations. One of them, I assume, is to love your fellow man. I don't know how you legislate that. Maybe one of the things is they open up grand jury proceedings.
Jay in Winchester.
If a trial is a public trial, even though you're right, it's only quasi-public in the federal courts.
Well, mostly open because they're big enough to accommodate most people.
No, I'm talking about a grand jury. What's the argument? I'm sure there's a decent one. I haven't heard of. What's the argument for a regular jury
maybe
trial being public?
Prosecutors want it that way, Jim.
Well, maybe it is. Well, the statutes allow it, so I don't know what the answer is.
But again, there's all this – everybody's kind of swimming in the same sea. The prosecutors, the police, the politicians, it's all kind of –
Well, but Beacon Hill, we talk about all the time. Beacon Hill is overpopulated with defense attorneys. It would seem to me that natural assumption would be if there were ever a group of people who would like to see more sun shine into a grand jury proceeding – it's a defense attorney. Why isn't there advocacy for that there? I'm sure there's a good reason. If someone knows it, call us or tweet us or email us.
But if someone is indicted, then the defense attorney gets a job defending the person who's indicted. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where they would necessarily have a reason to get involved at that point. They can represent the person after they're arraigned, et cetera. Anyway, Jay from Winchester. What do you think, Jay?
Hi, Jay.
Hi, you two. Glad to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm going to fall on the heels of KK and point a finger at, I think that American police are either inculcated or trained or feel they have the right to escalate situations way past where they need to go. And I there's a piece of evidence that I think of all the time. There's a video that I watch every time that I read up on one of these kids getting shot or somebody getting strangled on the street by police, where it's footage from Britain. Anybody can Google this on YouTube. And there's a guy in the streets with a machete. And there's maybe 15, 20 cops around this guy. And they're just waiting him out, you know? And like one or two cops will sort of move in on him for a little bit, and they'll charge at him swinging the machete, and they'll back up, and they'll sort of run around behind their car. And like another one will grab a big green recycling bin and sort of advance on the guy with the machete, like with the recycling bin between him and the guy will be swinging the machete. And they're waiting him out. Like, what is the big deal? Why do we have to meet the force of this guy with equal or greater force all the time? He's not going to disappear from the face of the planet.
Well, you know, the place where that was raised, I don't mean the British example, but the place about restraint. Well, I guess it's raised in all three of the most recent cases. But in the case of Tamir Rice, the little 12-year-old boy, they were talking about, why did the police car drive right up in front of him? Why didn't they park their car 50 yards away, call for reinforcements? The kid wasn't going anywhere, even if they really thought he had a real gun as opposed to a fake gun. So I don't know about the British example, but restraint, I mean, isn't that the basic – that's what they're trained in. When you hear people say mere people who are not law enforcement types, well, these are really provocative situations. That's what cops are supposed to be trained to deal with, no?
Yeah, I think American cops either are trained to do it the way they're doing it, or this just belligerent American attitude where, like, if I back away or if I stand down or if I cool it off, that represents a loss of authority or power. And it's like stand your ground rules, which are insane. Like, you're not legally obligated to just step back. when a guy is threatening you.
But when did the British cops get guns? Remember, they just had the nightsticks there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Isn't this a fairly recent arrival?
I don't know.
I'm not sure, but you know something.
Jay, thanks for the call.
You know, we don't want to go crazy here and paint everybody with this broad brush of being all a bunch of macho, can't wait to get into a big breakdown in the middle of the street, because we all know cops who I think are not like that at all. I mean, they really have done great work. They've walked the beat. They've tried to help kids. They know who the gang, the impact players, as they call them here in Boston, are, and do great work. But there are some, and there are, I would like to believe that there are very few of them, bad apples. And when the bad apples do bad things, you've got to come down on them hard. And that's the problem, that when people step out of line, there seems to be no accountability. That's the problem.
Well, also, when you see that good cop you're talking about, and again, Evans, Commissioner Evans confirmed this the other day, that it taints all of them. Obviously, he doesn't like it, but that's true. When you see the Pantaleo in Staten Island and Wilson in Ferguson get away with this, that next cop you see, who you ordinarily know is someone who you can trust, human nature would suggest, as unfair as this is, your level of trust in him or her is going to be diminished.
And you know, one other quick thing before we get back to the calls. You know, people talk about all the time the clearance rate in Boston, Suffolk County, is difficult in a lot of these murder cases.
Explain what clearance is.
That you don't get convictions. Mm-hmm. You arrest someone for murder, they're tried, and they don't get convicted. And one of the problems is that the young people, and these are a lot of crimes in minority areas where people know who the shooters were, they don't want to tell the cops. And they don't want to tell the cops because of the no snitching thing, but they're also not sure that they're going to be, because the relationship is not good between the cops and the kids, they're not going to trust the cops. And that's one of the things the commissioner, to his credit, talks about all the time, is developing these relationships. So when there are crimes, the kids are going to go tell the cops. But if the kid is thinking that the cop's going to beat you up, or the cop's going to arrest you, or the cop's going to harass you or hassle you, then obviously they're not going to go help you out, even if someone is shot right next to you on your block. Anyway, Jasmine from West Roxbury. Hi, Jasmine.
Hello, Jasmine.
Hello. I want to bring to attention is one of the issues is that the prison system has become more like a big corporation. It's getting too big. There's a lot of people that's in the prison system that shouldn't even be in there. And I think it reflects how the police officers are policing these communities. I give you an example. Myself, I'm an African-American woman, young African-American woman living below poverty line, and I see all the time, even with myself, being harassed by police officers, stepping their boundaries, rights being violated, but we don't have money to hire a lawyer or speak out against it. So I noticed that the new medium is trying to record it and show the rest of the world, like, we're being oppressed. There's people in America who's terrified of the police, you know, on a daily basis. And when people are failing their government, isn't it not tyranny?
Well, you know, when you said that there are people who are terrorized of their government, and I was reading from the Globe editorial before, you imagine that the three victims, Brown, Garner, and Tamir Rice in Cleveland, were white and in similar circumstances. If I were a young black man, I'd be in great fear of police, despite what my personal experiences have been. If all you have to do is watch the television, all you have to do is walk the streets. So, I mean, I think you make a fine point. By the way, one positive thing about the prison system, one can criticize the Obama administration on a lot of criminal justice things. One thing that Holder and Obama have really focused on is getting more minor drug offenders, for example, which has a dramatically disproportionate impact on blacks, Latinos, young men. Less prison time in those kinds of instances, which I think is hopefully a positive development. Let's take one more, and then we got to wrap this up. Paul, you're in Melrose. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Paul.
Good afternoon. How's it going?
Good.
So I think, let me refocus this quickly. I think that the important point here that we might be able to find some consensus with is in the flaws in the grand jury system, exactly what Marjorie was talking about. The idea that we're the only Western civilized country that still has a grand jury system, that we're the only country that continues to allow this sort of secrecy, that there's no you as a grand juror can't even, not saying we love this idea, but you can't even go on 60 Minutes like a month later and say, here's what was presented to us. You have sworn to secrecy as part of the grand jury. That's point number one. I think on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the political spectrum, you can find common ground in the idea that this grand jury system
doesn't work for anyone. Because even if this officer were innocent, if there were some, there were no video, this was the case that came up, you would think that he would want to be cleared out in the light of day, right? In the public.
Hey, Paul, before you continue, you say we're the only Western country or whatever uses this flawed grand jury system. What else happens? Prosecutors just decide whether to charge or not charge? Is that what happens?
Well, there's right, but it's done in a more public forum.
Well, that's Marjorie's theme, and I agree with her, and I agree with you.
Well, that's what I was confused about. You know, you see a lot of people that are arrested for a crime, and they are arraigned for that crime, and then they are, if it's a serious crime, then they're held or they get bail, whatever it is, and then the trial date is set. By the way, in terms of why grand juries are private, we got a couple of emails from lawyers saying that if no bill issues, no indictment, a legitimate sentence is not put through the humiliation of publicly known false charges.
Doesn't make any sense.
Say when I think of people that have been before the grand jury, we all knew who they were, right? I
mean, well, in virtually all cases, maybe
yeah.
Not in
I mean,
all
I suppose
cases.
There were maybe some secret people that we didn't know about. For the most part, we know whose case is before the grand jury, and I don't think it's a very good system. I think I've said that over and over again. Anyway, we're going to take a break because we're going to talk with Edgar B. Herwig III. He is the man behind the Curiosity Desk. He's been taking some questions for you, and he's going to be back with another round of his answers, which includes some of the news that you'll be pumped about. And that's a hint. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
And right after Edgar and right after the end of Boston Public Radio, the takeaway will return to the topic of Eric Garner. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. As I said a couple of minutes ago, the takeaway at 2 o'clock will return the discussion to Eric Garner and the failure of the grand jury in Staten Island to indict the police officer. But right now in Studio 3 with us, with dispatches from the Curiosity Desk, is the man who sits behind it, Edgar B. Herwig III. He's been fielding your questions, listener questions. He's back with some really interesting answers, and we're told one of them actually will break news. Hello, Edgar.
Hello. Yeah, it's not something we do often on the Curiosity Desk, but we got some big news coming. So let's get right to the questions. We have some great questions, as we always do, coming to the Curiosity Desk. And of course, if you are out there listening and have a question, you can always email us at curiositydesk@wgbh.org. Here's our first listener question.
Hi, this is Jonathan Riggs. I live in Boston, Massachusetts. During a sporting event, when a fan runs onto the field, what law has he or she broken?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question.
This guy's great. He's a doctor in Boston. He said a couple years ago he's at Fenway Park and a fan runs out on the field and gets tackled. And he turned to his girlfriend and he was like, what's happening here? What law did he break? So the answer here, I spoke with Lieutenant Mike McCarthy from the Boston Police Department.
Oh, he's terrific.
And asked
him,
he's after
really
we've been trashing
guy.
Cops here
know,
for 45
right?
minutes,
now,
he's a good one.
McCarthy.
He's great.
So one interesting aspect of this is that the cops will not chase anybody on a professional field. That's Fenway Park or another stadium. They let security handle that. So security is the person who's going to take you down if you go out onto Fenway Park, and then they hand you over to the cops. And essentially, the answer is pretty simple. Fenway Park is private property. It's private property. So you're not allowed to trespass on private property if that property owner decides there are places in that property where you can't go. So what will happen is if you run out on the field, you'll get tackled by a security guard, brought over to the cops, and you'll be placed under arrest immediately. The charge is trespassing. They take you down to District 4, which is the local South End police station. You'll be booked, photographed, fingerprinted, and then either you're bailed out or you're taken to Roxbury District Court, depending on the time of day. And it's usually a fine. Now, there are some mitigating circumstances, which is to say there may be charges beyond what is the simple trespassing. Here is Mike McCarthy, Lieutenant Mike McCarthy, explaining what could happen if it's beyond trespassing.
Being drunk is not a crime.
Thankfully.
So it's not a drunk and disorderly charge. But say they hit a player or if they hit a security guard, then the charges can jump up to an assault and battery. You also have instances of people taking off their clothes and running onto the field. We don't see too many of that, but then you'd have something where you may have an indecent exposure or open and gross lewdness, that sort of stuff. If they exhibit that type of behavior, you know.
A little laughter there by the lieutenant.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the things he also said, which I think is really interesting, is that it's at police discretion whether or not when somebody's arrested, whether they want to let the media know what the person was arrested for, what they were booked for, right? This kind of thing. He said that they make it a point whenever somebody runs out on the field and the media is asking, what are some of the arrests that happened? They always, he says, they always release the name. And so his warning was, don't run out on the field because you don't want to go try to get a job and somebody Googles your name and you find out that you ran out on the field. The idea behind that is that they want to keep it from happening.
You know what's weird?
They don't go to the secret grand jury, Jim.
Before you go to number two, you know what's odd about this? Is that private security forces make the, quote, arrest, end quote, and then turn you over to public law enforcement officials.
They stop the act. They stop the act. They don't make the arrest, but they stop the act, take you into custody, then hand you over to police. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Fenway Park security, if you run out on the field, they're the ones who are going to tackle you. The police don't – they don't get in out on the field.
The only upside is if you're acquitted, you get a signed ball from David Ortiz. So Edgar forgot that. What's the second one, Edgar?
Indeed. All right. Let's get our second listener question here.
My name is Mike Payette. I live in Spencer, Massachusetts. Something that has gnawed at me for a number of years now is a question of how our borders here in New England between the states were determined. It's understandable where a state's borders might follow a river, lake, or other natural feature, but looking at the map of Mass, how did we end up with a kooky dip into Connecticut out in the town of Southwick?
I love that the guy's even thinking about this.
I know.
Oh,
I know.
That's a great point.
This is an insane story. It is insanely common. I'm going to do my best to boil it down. But if you don't know what he's talking about, go to Google. Go to Google. Just Google, you know, map of Massachusetts or of Connecticut. And I don't know if what you're talking about. If you see, we have basically a straight line between us and Connecticut, north south. And about midway through the state, there's this like notch.
Dip.
Right? This dip. So in Connecticut, they call it the notch. In Massachusetts, we call it the jog. I couldn't get to the root of what this jog means, but essentially it is this town of Southwick, which is in Massachusetts, though should be in Connecticut. And it all started way back in the colonial era, right? 1642. So Massachusetts colony at that time, their border was, according to their charter, right, was to run west, quote, from a point 3 miles south of the most southerly branch of the Charles River, right? So as things are developing, they decide, all right, we should survey this. We should survey the land and figure out where the border is, right? So they hire these guys, Nathaniel Woodward and Solomon Saffrey. How good are those names, right?
I like them.
You know, great.
Who, by all accounts, were not trained in this at all, right? They had no training in doing this, but they were skillful and approved artists. That was what they were. So rather than do what you would think they would do, which is kind of figure out longitude, latitude, and walk the land and set stakes down for the border, they, for some reason, decided to do it by water. So they set a stake sort of down by the water, said, all right, here's the starting point. And rather than walk over land, they got into a boat, they went out into Boston Harbor, they went down into Long Island Sound, they came up the Connecticut River, and somehow were like, I think it's about here. Plucked a stake down, right? So essentially, they were about 7 miles too far south. And this sets off 150 years of border dispute of the entire border between Connecticut and Massachusetts, right? So 1695, Connecticut, they do their own survey, and they're like, this isn't even close. You guys are about 7 miles too far south. And Massachusetts is like, we don't really care. It's 1702, Connecticut does another one. They say, all right, we have a charter. We looked at ours. You have a charter. We looked at yours. We kind of took both into account. We did another survey, and you're still too far south. And Massachusetts sort of said, yeah, we don't really care. So they're like, we're gonna hang on to this land.
Are the people in Southwick, are they glad they're in Massachusetts, or would they rather be in Connecticut?
Well, stick with me. So what ends up happening in 1713, essentially, both states get together. And they do something of a joint survey, and they fix most of it. They sort of decide, all right, let's split the difference. Let's make the border pretty good. And you can imagine at this time, not everything was settled, right? A lot of it was just the wild, so it didn't really matter. But in Southwick, in that area around Southwick, that was settled, right? There was people living there, and those people could be taxed. And so everywhere else, Massachusetts was like, all right, it's fine. We'll move the border a little bit. But right around Southwick, they were like, we're hanging on to this because we want to tax these people. And it went back and forth, and they fought. And, you know, eventually the Revolutionary War breaks out. It becomes a state. Finally, it takes all the way until 1803-04, where this disputed pocket, this notch, was finally laid to rest. Massachusetts got 5/8 of the territory. Connecticut got the other 3/8 of the territory. And we still have this pocket of land, the Southwick Jaw.
Okay, let's get to the news because this is the one that Marjorie
has
been talking
excited.
About for ages.
All right, you guys. So here's the deal. When you go, you guys have fielded this question. The governor,
oh, yes, we have.
The governor.
Oh, the governor has
gotten
it. That's
true.
That's
right. This question multiple times for you guys. But essentially, this all centers around filling up your gas at the gas pump. Here's our listener.
Hi, Edgar. This is Brad Schwarzenbach from Hudson, Massachusetts. And, you know, I moved to the Commonwealth in 2006, and something that struck me was at gas stations here in the Commonwealth, you don't have the mechanism that holds the handle in place on the pump, you know, on a cold winter's day, it's a really nice thing. Put my hands in my pockets or put in my gloves, I can kind of step away from the pump for a second. But you don't have those here. And I was wondering, you know, why is that?
It's a good question.
Take
right?
it away, Edgar.
Let me ask you guys a question. Take a guess. How many states in America also outlaw the use of these hold-open clips?
Zero.
Zero other states.
God, I was a guess
how
on my part.
Typical.
None.
How,
none.
Look at the look on Edgar's face. Yeah, the happiest I've ever seen.
There's a handful of cities or towns that do it, but no state statewide bans the use of these clips. Right?
By the way, when the governor was asked on our show about it, he didn't know the answer. He said he was going to check it out.
So,
okay, go ahead.
So here's where it stretches back essentially to the beginning of self-serve gas in Massachusetts. That's something that had to be regulated by the state and allowed by the state, and it falls under the fire code. Because they're worried about fire safety around gas stations, which makes sense. So in the 1970s, when they legalized self-serve gas in the state of Massachusetts, with it came this ban. So they have never been legal here in Massachusetts. Now, what's interesting about this that I learned is that essentially manufacturers of gas pumps, they don't make these gas pumps without these clips. So every single gas station owner for decades in Massachusetts has had to go and physically remove the clips from their gas pumps, right? Which is seemingly kind of crazy. But so here are the reasons. The reasons are twofold, right? The one makes logical sense, right? Which is they're worried about spillage. And certainly in the 70s, it would happen more often. They're worried that if you sort of set the clip open, it'll malfunction. The gas will still – your tank will fill up. It'll spill. That's dangerous. Yeah. That's messy, right? So that was the first fear. But the second fear – and this sounds far-fetched – but the second fear is the start of fire from static electricity. So what the worry is that you're going to set the pump going, you're going to get back into your car and stay warm. You're going to get back out of your car. In the process, you get all guzzied up with static electricity, and when you touch the pump again, it will spark and light a fire. Now, this happens about –
they don't have static electricity in the other 49 states
well,
or what?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this does happen. It happens about 14 times a year. Now, consider that people fill up their gas tanks 11 billion times a year. That means you have 1 in 10 million chance of this happening. So it essentially never happens. Here's the deal. We are now, as of January 1st, changing our fire code. And in this process of changing the fire code, we're going to a national fire code. They put this on the table. They said, should we go ahead and let these clips come to Massachusetts?
And?
They're coming.
Marjorie.
Oh, my God. Just in time for the coldest part of the winter.
So as of January 1st here in Massachusetts, for the first time in our state history, statewide, these clips will be allowed on self-service gas tanks throughout the state.
Curiosity Desk gets action.
I am so excited about that.
I am so excited.
I can't wait
my
to fill up my
hands are
going to
be so yeah. warm. It's going to be great.
Thank you very much.
I mean, think about this. From now on, you can get and put the thing in the
yeah, we got the concept, Marjorie. Put the thing in the thing.
You can go sit in your car. Now I talked with Fire Marshal. I talked with Fire Marshal Stephen Cohen. He's an awesome guy, and he said he's excited about this, but he said let's just be cautious. Don't set your pump going and get in your car and turn it on because it's still illegal to turn your car on. Don't go into the convenience store and wait in line for coffee and plug everything up. So be diligent is what he's asking. But they're coming, you guys. January 1st, you're going to be able to set your gas going and put your hands in your warm pockets as your gas tank fills up.
And you know what the expression is? That's to follow what he just said? You heard it here. Now, did you know this
before Edgar just said this? Well, actually, he whispered
this
it to me.
This is huge news,
didn't
guys.
Whisper
upstairs,
it to me. It is huge. By the way, it's going to affect virtually every person.
News. Almost
thank
every
you
driver
for that
in the basement.
I think they just sent out a press release right away. The Curiosity Desk gets action.
We're going to have a larger story about this on WGBHnews.org, so you can check that out. And, of course, if you have questions, I want to look into them for you. So send me an email, curiositydesk@WGBH.org.
I have one question. Can
yes.
I email it right now?
Yes,
why does
Jim.
The guy out there care about the little notch in Massachusetts and Connecticut? That's what I want to know.
Wait, say this again.
Why does the guy care about the notch?
Because it's super interesting.
Okay,
like,
fine.
It's the weirdest thing.
But you know something? It's a weird notch. I mean, look at the map.
It doesn't make
you
any
just
sense.
Say to yourself, why is this notch
okay,
there?
I
never knew it.
You know what? It's a classic example of if you get there first, even if it's a mistake, it's hard to undo that mistake in the rule of law.
All I care about is the gas cap. Okay, fine. Goodbye.
Right, Edgar
thank
B.
you, Edgar.
Hurwitz III. I love talking to you. He is the guy that runs WGBH's Curiosity Desk. It's great to have you here. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We have an interview with Walter Isaacson. We're so excited about that. And the famous playwright Eve Ensler wrote The Vagina Monologues. You get a new play over the ART. Our show is a production of WGBH. Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Rosip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer is John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
You're who I am?
I believe you're Jim Brady.
No, I am the guy who's going to fill up my gas tank on January 1st of 2015, just standing by with my hands in my pockets. That's who I am.
Okay.
See you tomorrow.
Bye. Thanks.